Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for the Tech Guy is provided by CacheFly. CacheFly.com.
Hi, this is Leo Laporte, and this is my Tech Guy podcast. This show originally aired on the premier radio networks, including 180 of the best stations in the world, on Sunday, July 8th, 2012. This is episode 890. Enjoy. The Tech Guy podcast is brought to you by ShareFile. Enhance your workflow. Send files of almost any size easily and securely with ShareFile from Citrix. Try ShareFile today for a 30-day free trial. Visit ShareFile.com. Click the radio microphone and enter the promo code TechGuy. And by Ford, featuring the MyFord mobile smartphone app for electric vehicles. The MyFord mobile app makes electric driving fun and efficient. Learn more about Ford electric vehicle technologies at Ford.com/technology. Well, hey, 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 how are you today? Good day to you. Leo Laporte here, the Tech Guy. And it's time to talk about computers and the internet and cell phones and camcorders and MP3 players and home theater and, well, anything else that's on your mind, as long as it's got a chip in it. I am the Technology Guy. Phone number is 888-827-5536. 888-827-5536. Toll free from anywhere in the U.S., outside the U.S., Skype ad will work for you. All you have to do is call that toll-free number. It won't cost you a penny. 8888. Ask Leo. Well, this is a week that will be forever remembered. This is one of the perhaps the most significant week in the 21st century. People are going, what? Yes. Because they discovered the Higgs boson. I just read an article by a particle scientist, or I guess she's a materials scientist, bemoaning the fact that the most important scientific discovery of the 21st century happened this week. The most important discovery of the 21st century happened this week. And everybody's going, huh? What? What does it mean? Well, because unfortunately, the way science has gotten, especially particle physics, ion particle physics, it's kind of a subject that only well, I think Einstein said the only two people in the world understand theory of relativity, and one of them's me. So in Forbes magazine today, actually, Anissa Ramirez, who is a materials scientist and a TED talker at Yale University, said this discovery is up there with Copernicus discovering or revealing that the Earth revolved around the sun. If we did not find the Higgs boson, this subatomic particle they discovered at the Large Hadron Collider, the LHC, everything we understood or we thought we understood about the universe, how the universe works, would have been wrong. They built this LHC, this $10 billion science project. If you ever do a science project in school, $10 billion budget. That's not a baking soda volcano we're talking here. The Large Hadron Collider is the biggest scientific apparatus ever built. It fires subatomic, it basically attempts to recreate the Big Bang, and fires subatomic particles along an 11-kilometer tube at close to the speed of light, attempting to discover this one elusive particle, the Higgs boson. And, you know, when it first started, there was, remember all the problems they had, all the things that broke? And there were two physicists who said, actually, these were respected physicists, the Higgs boson does not want to be discovered. And And that's why the LHC keeps breaking. Well, they have now you have to understand how science works. Science never really proves anything. But with almost complete certainty, They believe they have the evidence, the traces. Nobody's seen it, but the traces of the Higgs boson. And without this, you can't explain why particles have mass. Your whole physical model of the universe breaks, and you have to rethink it. I read one paper by a scientist who said, "I'm so disappointed." Now we know everything. They did, believe me. They don't. There's plenty to be. There's plenty to be learned. But he was a little disappointed that, in fact, it was a true. It was true. He thought, well, golly, now we're gonna have to find news. Stephen Hawking was this. He lost a $100 bet. The greatest physicist alive said, "Oh, you'll never." You'll never discover the Higgs boson. I bet you $100. A decade ago, he said that we will never find proof. Hawking said this is an important result and should earn Peter Higgs, the man for whom the particle is named, the Nobel Prize. But it's a pity in a way because the great advances in physics have come from experiments that gave results we didn't expect. For this reason, I had a bet with Gordon Kane of the University of Michigan that the Higgs particle wouldn't be found. It seems I've just lost $100. So it brings us much closer to understanding what matter is made of, how the universe works. Our standard model of physics apparently is accurate. Kind of amazing that this guy, Higgs, predicted this. He said there has to be this thing, this particle that we haven't discovered to explain it all. And we did. Then we went out. We built this $10 billion collider. I got the numbers wrong. It is a 17-mile-long circular tunnel. And it gets these subatomic particles, these protons, accelerated to nearly the speed of light. They go around the 17-mile-long tunnel 11,000 times a second. Then, bang! They hit another particle, and you watch carefully for traces of this elusive Higgs boson. So I'm sure you heard about it. It was in the news. The problem is I don't think normal people, non-physicists, can really understand what it means. But take it from these people, these brilliant people like Stephen Hawking. This is a big deal. What Anissa Ramirez calls the greatest scientific discovery of the 21st century. Of course, it's only 12 years in, so there's plenty of time for more. You know where we get our science from these days? Big Bang Theory. So we'll see what Sheldon says. That'll tell us. Then we'll know. Then we'll understand. Then the world will understand it's important. But I couldn't start the show without mentioning the most important discovery of our century. Oh, here's some depressing news. We talked before about this new Apple laptop, the MacBook with Retina display. I bought one. Beautiful. Love it. Best laptop I've ever had. I say that without any hesitation. It's amazing. Gorgeous screen. Very thin. Very powerful. Very unrecyclable. And this is unfortunately a problem. Apple created, with other electronics groups, a standard called EPEAT, E-P-E-A-T, for recycling. An environmental standard was funded by the Environmental Protection Agency and manufacturers. It awards a seal to certify that products are recyclable and designed to maximize energy efficiency and minimize environmental harm. Apple this week withdrew from EPEAT and is pulling its 39 certified computers, monitors, and laptops. And the speculation is that it's because of this MacBook Retina. You know, the iPhone and the iPad have never been EPEAT certified because they're all glued together. In order to be EPEAT certified, a product has to be able to be disassembled and fully recycled. You have to be able to take the batteries out and recycle them, take the glass out, the LCD screen out. You have to be able to recycle them individually. And we've long known that iPads are not, that you cannot recycle these responsibly. And now with this newest laptop, because everything is glued in, the glass display is glued to the back, the battery is glued to the case, the product was never submitted to certification. And Apple, unfortunately, is now pulling all of its products from EPEAT. And this is a big deal. This is a big deal because the U.S. government requires that 95% of the electronics it purchases be certified. Ford, Kaiser Permanente, HSBC require that they only purchase EPEAT certified products. So believe me, Apple, you know, doesn't like this because it's going to limit their market. But I think they made the decision, and it saddens me, to favor design over the environment. And it's pretty much evidence that they've given up by withdrawing everything from EPEAT. So some good news, some sad news, and now your turn. Let's talk. 8888 Ask Leo. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
So I say no to status quo. Who wants to be like the rest and deny the best?
I guess you were listening in the break, huh, Kyle Venom?
Always listening, Leo.
So I won't say this person's name. But I got a, you know, when you're on the radio, you get books all the time, pitches to get authors on the air and all that stuff. And Penguin has a new book, which actually sounds pretty provocative, called Trust Me, I'm Lying, Confessions of a Media Manipulator. You know, I probably should read this. A guy named Ryan Holiday. But the thing that scares me is the person who edited the book sent me a cover letter. You know, they always do. Dear Leo, for an editor, the most exciting books are the ones you're a little afraid of. The ones that take risks. Challenge the status quo. What? I wouldn't make that up. So I won't say her name because she's supposed to be a book editor. But I think it's status quo. I think that's actually it's quo, not quote. There's no such thing as status quo. Just tip for future reference. 8888 Ask Leo. That's the phone number. Now, somebody in the chat room. And by the way, we have a great chat room. If you want to join us there, I'd love to have you in there. Because it's kind of like the kids in the back of the class who tell me when I say things like status quo. And I like that. I appreciate it. I appreciate the corrections. You can get there by going to our website, techguylabs.com. And there's a link there that goes to chat. Or if you already have a chat client, it's just irc.twit.tv. But somebody in our chat room tells me that I completely bollocksed my explanation of the Higgs boson. The Higgs bogus. You were wrong, says Mark Boston 28, on your explanation. That's just a typo. I won't hold it against you. That's a typo. Your explanation. You were wrong in your explanation of the Higgs boson. I want to correct that, so I admit it. I am no physicist. So what is the explanation of the Higgs? You tell me. Call me, 8888 Ask Leo. I'd love to hear from a physicist. But it's my understanding probably completely amiss because I don't understand this stuff. You know, mostly nowadays, modern physics is math. You know, it's you can't even in your head, I doubt anybody can make sense of things like string theory. It's just math, you know. So, and I've talked to Michio Kaku, who is one of the best-known proponents of string theory, many times. I've interviewed him perhaps a dozen times. He's one of those great scientists who is a great talker, can explain stuff. And I've asked him, and he's explained it in as many ways as he could possibly do it. But you can't. It's not words. It's math. And if you don't understand the math, forget it. But it's my understanding that this Higgs boson thing just confirms our model of the way things work. And Peter Higgs had this idea, you know, but it's interesting because I remember this from my high school physics. In the early days of physics, not so long ago, maybe 100 years ago, they had this concept of ether because they couldn't explain how light would propagate in a vacuum. So they had this kind of invisible field that the light was kind of moving the light along. In the same way that air moves sound along, it was called the ether, and it was the only way they could make sense of how things could possibly work. And then, of course, with quantum theory and the Michelson-Morley experiments and so forth, they realized there is no ether. They had this idea there was an etheric wind that pushed light along. There is no. So the Higgs boson to me, now correct me if I'm wrong, sounds a little bit like that. Like, well, we can't figure out why anything has mass, so there must be some magic particle. That when it kind of comes into proximity, these particles come into proximity, they acquire mass. The boson's giving them mass. Please, explain me. Because I don't understand the status quo. By the way, Dr. Mom explains it. She edits audiobooks. Of course, there you go. That's 8888 Ask Leo. I love this stuff. Oh, now, okay, so TW has given me a link to a YouTube video that explains it. That'll do it. Boy, if you can't understand the math, there's one easy solution. There must be a YouTube video on it. I make fun of that. I was talking to my brother-in-law, actually, who's a dean at a prestigious university. And I've talked to many educators in the past about how education is changing. One of the things that really seems to be changing is that because of the ease and predominance of video and the ease of making video, that we're turning education on its head. Remember we had a caller, it was a teacher a few weeks ago, who said, you know, the new thing is kids do their homework in school. We record the best version of the lecture. We put it on YouTube. We say, you watch this when you go home tonight. This is the lecture. You don't need to be in person for that. Just watch it at your convenience at home. And then when you come into school, we'll work problems. We'll solve this at school. We'll do the one-on-one in school. That makes a lot of sense to me. So I'll watch the, it was a seminar actually held at CERN this week on the Higgs boson. It's on the, I can't even say the name of the channel. It's a Yugoslav name. Well, tell you what, we'll put a link in the show notes. Higgs is misspelled, so that gives me a little nervousness about the video. But I'm sure it's accurate. Anyway, I don't want to be a grammar pedant. Matthew in Enola, PA, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Matthew.
Hi, Leo. I'm hoping you can spend some of my money.
Oh, I love spending people's money. Go ahead.
I'm a full-time work-at-home employee, and I'm trying to use Skype for all my telephone calls.
Ah.
And I've been looking for a better USB headset with just a few features, and I'm really stumped. The most important thing is, I believe you had one of these, where if you moved your mouth away from the microphone just a little bit, it wouldn't pick you up.
Oh, yeah, you want something that's highly directional is what you're saying. Because you don't want room noise, you don't want fans, you don't want background noise.
That would be ideal.
Yeah.
And also, if it had one or no ear speakers, because I like to play the caller's voice through my computer, and I want something comfortable on my head. And I just don't know what to look for. That there's like no buzzword that I know of.
I'll give you the buzzword, but I doubt you'll find it. So what you're looking for, most microphones and all the microphones on headsets that I know of are what we call omnidirectional. They pick up sound equally in all directions. And that's what you don't want. You want a unidirectional or directional microphone. A microphone, and by the way, all the microphones radio stations use, including the one I'm using right now, are unidirectional. It's one of the ways that you make it sound, you don't hear noise in the background. And you could tell if I get off axis on my microphone, I'm using a Heil PR40, but if I get off, watch, I'm speaking right into it now. As I go off axis, it gets very, I'm only a few inches off axis, and you could see the difference in the quality of the sound. That's what you want. You want a directional microphone. Problem is, I don't know of any on inexpensive anyway USB headsets. I'll tell you the one that we use and recommend. It is comfortable over the ears. It gives you very good quality. The microphone is noise canceling, so this might help you. It's Plantronics, the Dot Audio 995. The Dot Audio 995. That's the one I use and recommend. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Extreme. We have a new theme. I think this is the new tech guy theme, and I'll call myself Super Tech Guy. Da-da-da-da. Faster than a speeding CPU. More powerful than a terabyte hard drive. So last show, yesterday, we had a poor... I felt terrible. I had 3 seconds left in the show, and I picked up a call. I said, hi, Tess from Burbank. Oh, I'm out of time. Bye. So I felt... I'm so sorry, Tess. So we got you back, and I apologize for having to do that. I was just not paying attention to the clock. So thank you for being here for us now. Thank you.
No, thank you.
So what were you going to ask before we ran out of time?
I have like a HP Wenten netbook.
Okay.
And it's a huh?
Okay, I'm just saying. Okay.
Oh, okay, and it's stuck on that problem signature 6-1. It's like an endless repair thing. It just wants to launch a repair thing, and it just goes round and round and round. And so, I was trying to fix it myself.
I think you probably can't. I would guess. I think you probably can't. It sounds like so that HP 110 is a what we call a netbook. Okay. And let me just check real quickly. I don't think it has a spinning hard drive. It's got an Intel Atom processor, a megabyte of cache, a gigabyte of RAM. Oh, no, it does have a real hard drive, a 320 gigabyte hard drive.
The guy I bought it from, I don't know, he put a different hard drive in it. Oh, boy.
So you didn't buy it. You didn't buy it new. You bought it used from some guy who put his own thing in it.
Right. I've had it about 4 months or something like that.
I'm going to guess that's too bad. So it's not new, which means you can't really bring it to HP. How much did you pay for it?
$200.
Really? Because it only is $300 new.
Yeah, it's like almost $200, not quite.
All right. And he put a new hard drive in there, he said, huh?
Yeah, it's got a, I got it right here. Let's see. It's got a new SATA hard drive. It's upgraded. It had Windows XP, I guess, but it's upgraded to Windows 7 Pro 32-bit.
Okay, that's an upgrade, yeah, because it comes with a much worse version of Windows, the Home Starter Edition. It's a cheap notebook, I have to say. And it worries me a little bit that he did some stuff to it, because that sounds like that's what the error is.
I wasn't really, that's what I'm thinking too, because there's all these files on there. And so when I go into the thing, like I tried the disk part and I tried going into the...
The recovery that it wants to run isn't on that new hard drive. If you put a different hard drive in there, it was only on the original hard drive. So you can't run that recovery. So what it's saying to you is,
I can't run it. Everything I tried to do, the restore, it's driving me crazy. I tried everything.
It won't work, Tess, because he took it out. He took it out. When he put a new... So the restore comes from the hard drive. And when he put in a new hard drive with a new operating system on it, he clearly did not restore the old recovery partition. That's the part of the hard drive designed to recover it. And now what's happening is there's damage...
It was all in there. I found that partition thing you're talking about and everything, and I thought, my problems are over. But somehow... accidentally deleted something, so now it says my boot manager is missing.
So it's probably unrecoverable at this point. I think that what he did made it impossible to recover, and I think what you okay so I'm looking at the chat room. Somebody says I have fixed a situation like this, he says. And you can do it by apparently putting a new boot manager on it. Do you have a USB thumb drive, a little USB memory stick anywhere? You do?
Uh-huh.
All right.
Yeah.
So, do you have another computer you could get somewhere?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, totally.
Okay. So, there is a free boot manager. This is a guess. But there's a free. But this guy in the chat room said he's done this. So there's a free boot manager called GAG, as in
gag.
It's a gag me with a spoon. Except it isn't really. It's the guy's Spanish, and GAG apparently is a reasonable acronym in Spain. I don't know what it means in. It should work for you. And the beauty of it is, it's free. You can download it, put it on a USB key. Now, what you'll have to do is tell the HP to boot from the USB key. And then GAG will say, okay, I see a couple of different partitions. I can blah, blah. It'll replace the boot manager. And this is actually a better boot manager, I think. So if you go to gag.sourceforge.net on the existing gag.sourceforge.net. SourceForge, yeah.
SourceForge.
Yep. .net. Yep.
Okay.
And you get Gag, and then put that, it'll instruct you on what to do. And you download the file. It's a very, very small download because a boot manager can't be too big. It's a little zip file. You could put it on your USB key and then boot to the USB key. Gag will look at what's on the hard drive and say, okay, I'm going to install myself, okay? And you say, yes. And if that's all that's messed up, and maybe more, understand, this is just an attempt. You've tried all the normal things.
This is all that's messed up because I almost had it, and I accidentally, when I was in there with all these files and stuff like that, and it said suddenly, because I found this tutorial thing, and I did it all, and I swear I almost had it, and it said it was going to override something, and I'm like, yeah, whatever. And then when it came back on, it said my boot manager is missing.
Yeah. I bet that's what it overrode, right? Yeah.
So
I think that's going to, well, it's worth a try.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you, Tess. I mean, at least you didn't pay a whole lot for it. It's not a very high-end device. Brand new, it was only $299. So maybe your buddy will stand behind it and fix it. Because I think whatever happened, it happened to the hard drive. The hard drive kind of had a problem. Let's go to Boston, Massachusetts. JP is on the line. We got some Bostonians in the studio, actually. Hey, JP.
Hey, Leo. I'm a longtime Mac fanboy, and I'm making the switch to Windows.
Oh, my. Why are you doing that?
Well, I'm an engineering student, and...
That's all you need to say. all the software you want to runs on Windows.
Exactly, yeah. So I ordered a new Asus laptop, and I configured it so that I have a small SSD drive, and the operating system is going to be installed on that.
Good.
So what I wanted to know is, you know, when I get the computer, where are the files going to map to? In other words, like, where's my documents folder going to be?
Yeah, this is very different from the way a Macintosh works. So I'll give you kind of since you're an engineering student, I'll give you the quick description of how Windows works. So the way Windows works is there's a master boot record. That's actually what we were talking about with Tess. That's the first thing that loads up. And then Windows enumerates the drives in boot order as C, D, E, F, G, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Your C drive is always where the operating system, the boot operating system, lives. Now, you can have a boot manager there that will boot to a different drive, but you aren't using multiple operating systems. So Windows will live on that C drive. That will be where the SSD drive, that's what you want it to be. All applications you install by default, unless you say otherwise, will install on that C drive. That's fine because that's your fastest drive. You want to put your data on the other drive, your D drive. I'll describe a little bit more when we come back. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. All we've learned so far about the Higgs boson, we're watching a video together, me in the chat room, from a blog called It's Okay to Be Smart. I love it. It's a Tumblr by a scientist, I guess. I hope he's a scientist. There's a good video about the Higgs boson. And so far what I've learned is that, in fact, scientists at CERN do eat French fries. So that's good. The Higgs boson, however, is not a food particle. No, that's not true. I was talking about drive mapping with JP in Boston. Let's finish that up, and then we'll get to Andrew in Vallejo, California. So that is a little different from the way Apple does it. Apple, you know, you name the drives. Windows, those drive letters are all important. You boot in that order, in alphabetical order. So your C drive, which is your Windows drive, I hope that's your SSD, and I hope it's large enough to include not only Windows, which is a few gigabytes, but also any applications you may want to install. Generally, I'd say 20 gigs dedicated would be fine. How much do you have for your SSD?
It's a 64 gigabyte.
You're beautiful. You're good. Unless you're installing, you know, programs that take a huge amount of space, that should be fine. Then you want a D drive for your data. Now, Windows, what the Windows works somewhat like the Macintosh in this respect. You do have a home folder, that's what the Mac calls it, where your stuff is. Each login on Windows has its own folder. It's located in the Documents and Settings folder. But it does not have to reside on C. In fact, it's my suggestion it not reside on C. Put it on D. That way, if you have to reinstall Windows, for instance, you don't touch your data. Plus, it keeps the data off the SSD. That's fine. Your main benefit from the SSD, the solid-state drive, is in reading. So you want to put stuff that you mostly read there, and that really is Windows and the applications. So your users folder should be on D. It's pretty easy to change that in Windows. In fact, all you have to do is right-click on your users on your folder. It'll be your name, your login. And go to Properties, and you can say, I want this to live here. And it'll live there from then on. The only trick with Windows is that applications sometimes ignore settings if you put applications in other than in C. So I just, for general purposes, I just install everything onto C. You may say, well, gosh, I only have 64 gigs. But I think that's going to be plenty. If you have an issue with some applications taking up so much space, you could try putting them on D. They don't like it.
Okay.
All right. That's the biggest difference. Well, thank you. I appreciate it. Enjoy your experience with Windows. You're going Windows 7, right?
Yes.
Yeah, I think Windows 7 is actually very, very good. I don't think you'll have any issues making the shift. For Mac users going to Windows and for Windows users going to Mac, there's some strange little things. You just have to get used to the fact that, for instance, in the Macintosh, you always have a menu bar at the top of the window, always. And whatever the frontmost window is determines what that menu bar is. On Windows, there is no menu bar on the desktop. Each window has its own menu, which frankly makes a little bit more sense to me. So if you have, you're working in the one window, that menu bar will be at the top of that window, not on the desktop. That's one thing that's weird. Also, the gadgets on the windows are a little different. They're the same in the sense they do the same things. There's a close window button. There's a maximize window button. There's a minimize window button, but they're on the left instead of the right. Or is it the right instead? They're on the right instead of the left. Little things like that. You'll get used to all of those. It is not a huge difference. Less than one might think from the way Mac and Windows people sometimes fight. A lot of people are asking me about Windows 8. Should I wait? Will I like it? Windows 8 will probably be out around October time. There will be a whole slew of new PCs, although if you buy a PC today from most manufacturers, you'll get a $15 upgrade to Windows 8. My suggestion is to try the Windows 8 Consumer Preview. It's a free download from Microsoft before you make the decision. It is very different. There is a bigger difference between Windows 8 and Windows 7 than there is between Windows 7 and Macintosh. Much, much. That's going to be a bigger shift. People moving to Windows 8 are going to have to relearn a lot of things. There's no start menu. There's a start screen. Applications tend to want to run in full screen. You have to learn there's special places to put your mouse, special keystrokes to make to get things to happen. Shutting down, for instance, on Windows 8 is a very strange sequence of commands. It's Windows key I, click the, is it devices? Charm. I can't. You have to click a special charm, and then you can shut down. It's very confusing. Now, some people like it. I'm not saying you'll hate it, but I would very much suggest that you try the Windows 8. If you're on a Macintosh, it's easy. You can just run a virtual machine, use VMware Fusion or Parallels or Sun's what is it called? Virtual Box. And run it within there. That's how I do it. And then it's just a file. It doesn't change anything. So you can see, well, gosh, this is different. Is it something you can live with is the question. So the shutdown process, you move your mouse to the right-hand corner. The charms show up. You select settings. Then you select power. Then you select shutdown. That's how you turn it off. But there's some other things that are non-intuitive that actually are great. For instance, let's say you want to run an application and you're sitting on the start screen, you don't have to do anything with your mouse. You just type the first few letters of the application. It'll find it, and then you hit return. So there are some things that are, I think, quite cool. I'm just saying it's very different. It's a bigger difference from 7 to 8 than it is from Mac to Windows. And I think Windows 7 is the best version of Windows ever. I'm going to stick with it, probably. I think it's fine. I know how to use it. Does what I want it to do. I don't see any real advantage to going to Windows 8. Andrew Vallejo, California, you're next. We're going to talk. Do I need to do a commercial here, though? Do I, Kyle?
Yeah, not 32.
Okay. We're going to come to you next, Andrew, on moving and downsizing. And he's in a smaller place. I can help you with this because I did the same thing. I moved to an apartment, but he wants his stereo loud. How do you do it? Soundproofing for your stereo next. So the DNS, the way to test to see if you've got this bug, by the way, is a website that they finally set up, dns-ok.us. And if you get green, you're okay. If you get red, tomorrow you will lose your internet access. dns-ok.us. Mark, we're going to soundproof your living room in just a little bit. Or, I'm sorry, Andrew, stay tuned. Lots more to come. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. All right, I'm going to watch the rest of this.
Your life is on your computer.
It's okaytobesmart.com. We're going to find out about the Higgs boson. Yes, please.
I mean, to make up everyday matter, you only need the electron, the up quark, and the down quark. Because with the up quark and the down quark, you can make a proton or you can make a neutron, right? Electrons and protons and neutrons, you can make any atom. So you only need these three. But there's, how many particles are there we've discovered? 12? Why do we have them? I don't know. How many are there? 100? A million? Only 12? We don't know. We're like looking at the tip of the iceberg here and wondering, is there a huge iceberg under the water or is this it? And what does it mean in either way, right? We're looking for patterns. It's just like the periodic table. You take all the elements and you organize them by their characteristics and they fall into categories. And these guys over here tend to behave one way. These guys tend to behave another way. Why? Because there's a fundamental underlying structure. And now we know it's just electron orbitals around nuclei. So we have a periodic table of the fundamental particles. And like the periodic table, we've been putting it together and trying to organize it by the characteristics of the particles. And it has some interesting features. It has patterns which suggest there must be some sort of underlying structure that we don't understand. But we haven't seen it yet. There's six quarks. Up, down, charm, strange, top, bottom. These guys we call leptons. These are just names. There's an electron, muon, tau. And these guys interact with each other. These two interact with each other. These two interact with each other. Same way, these guys are paired. There's all these pairings. Is there more here? We don't know. What's the source of the patterns that we see in this table? We don't know. They're trying to figure out clues by figuring out what other kind of particles also exist. Like, what is out there? The thing is, we have this collider. And the magic of a collider is you can make kinds of matter in a collider that you don't have around. You can take two kinds of particles and annihilate them. And it's not like what comes out has to be a rearrangement of what went in. It's this quantum magic where it sort of disappears into pure energy. And then you can make any sort of particle for which you have enough energy. It's like you have a menu. You go to the restaurant, you have a menu, you're like, I have this much energy, so I can make anything that costs that much energy or less. So that's why you want to have as much energy as possible. And every time you crank up the energy, you could be exploring a whole new energy range, a whole new regime. It's like landing on a new planet, stock full of new particles nobody has ever seen, because nobody ever had the energy to make them. And as soon as we get over the threshold, boom, they just pop out. And so one of the things people predict is the Higgs boson. The idea is that the Higgs boson is the particle that is responsible for giving mass to the other particles. So you think of things that have mass means it has stuff to it. It's not actually stuff. Earlier I was saying electron has mass, but has no volume. How can that be? Mm-hmm. Turns out mass is probably just a characteristic of a particle the way, like, charge is. Like, some particles have charge, like electrons. Some particles don't. It's just a different kind of charge. So you can think of mass as sort of gravitational charge. And when two things both have mass, they attract each other. Right. Interestingly, you can't have negative mass or repulsive gravity. So gravity is different from other forces that way. The Higgs theory starts with this. Imagine a field that permeates the entire universe. And every particle feels this field, is affected by this field, in different amounts. So some particles are really slowed down by interaction with this field, like, you know, swimming through molasses, and other particles hardly feel it. So the ones that hardly feel it, they have a small mass. The ones that are really affected by it, they couple strongly to this field, are slowed down a lot, they have a large mass. So you've turned the question of why do particles have different masses into a different question. Why do particles feel the Higgs field differently? But there is one manifestation of the field is the existence of this particle. So there's lots of different reactions that could give you the Higgs. For example, one is you could have two gluons that fuse, give you a Higgs boson, and the Higgs could decay into two bottom quarks. The problem is, there's lots of other ways to make two bottom quarks. In fact, it's one of the most common things to make. You expect that to happen a million times more often from other kinds of processes than from the Higgs. The thing is, we can't see these reactions. We can't, like, watch them and slow them down, reverse them. All we can do is see the reaction, the decay products from the reaction. So this part is all you see, and what you really want to know is, did this intermediate state exist? Right, so the collision happens. It lasts for like 10 to the negative 23 seconds, and you get one measurement, right? So if you say, well, I'm going to plot the mass, the total energy of this guy. I'm going to add this guy and this guy together and add the total energy. This is this axis here is number of collisions. You do an individual experiment, you get one measurement, right? Here. You do another one, you get another measurement. You do another one. Eventually, you build up your data, right? And the data looks like this, for example. And then you have two theories, right, that predict the data. One says, well, I'm going to predict there's no Higgs boson, so the data should fall along this line. The other is I'm going to predict that plus a Higgs boson. And the problem is the difference between these two theories is very small. And so it's very hard to distinguish these two with our data because the predicted effect is tiny, right? If the predicted effect were huge, it'd be very easy to tell the difference between with Higgs boson or not with Higgs boson. But the predicted effect is tiny, and so it's really hard to see. What you need is a huge amount of data. You need to take a bajillion collisions before you can see the difference. That's why we run this thing 40 million times a second, all day, all year, to get a lot of collisions to tell small differences between theories. It's like when you take a picture of the sky. You just take a picture, you get a little bit of light. The longer you leave your telescope looking at the sky, the more you can see farther away things. But there's lots of other things that make the Higgs. There's 10 other ways you can see the Higgs. There are people working on that one also. We work in a collaboration of thousands of people, and there's people working on every single channel. Some people are working on this one, some people are working on this one. And the idea is to try to look everywhere simultaneously to see a little bit of evidence here and a little bit of evidence there and a little bit of evidence here can be combined into convincing evidence. So we're going to leave it running for a long time and hope that something new pops out. There's still a possibility for a lot of new things. We've been running for a little while. We haven't seen anything crazy yet, but there could still be crazy pink elephants in there waiting to pop out. That's why I was saying earlier in lunch, like, any day somebody could say, oh, we see something exciting. Every time you open your email, like, that could be the time you heard about, or every time your student makes a plot, like, what's in the data? What's in the data? It's exciting.
That's cool. Very cool. That's I think that's a good description of the story. That's from a website called It's Okay to Be Smart. And I know some of you found that boring. It's okay to be dumb, too.
You're tuned to Premier Channel.
Not as okay.
Leo Laporte, the tech guy, will begin at 6 minutes past the hour from Premier Radio.
I thought that was quite good. This is another one from PhD Comics. I follow this blog. It's a Tumblr blog. Looks good. It's very important stuff. Ignorant? Okay. Some people are ignorant. Some people are just dumb. It is okay to be dumb. It's not okay to be ignorant. You can only be as smart as you are. It's not okay to be ignorant. Here we go.
Well, hey, 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 how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the tech guy. Hour number two of the Tech Guy Show. Talking about computers, cell phones, home theater. Coming up in about half an hour, 33 after the hour, our photographer, Chris Marquardt, will join us with some digital photography tips and another assignment. Just an excuse to go out and shoot. 8888-ASK-LEO is the number, 888-827-5536. You can also visit our website, techguylabs.com, and it's waning days. It is an elderly website, soon to be replaced by a fresh, young website that has lots of nice features. It's in beta test right now. It's doing very well. We're very excited about that. I think in the next couple of weeks, certainly by August 1st, we'll have that up. But meanwhile, the stuff's still there. All the notes from 890 total shows. Everything I've talked about since 2004, for more than 8.5 years on that webpage. That's why it looks so old and gray. It's 8 years in a web, in the web world is, well, it's at least 10 years per human year, don't you think? It's an 80-year-old website. Time to retire it. It's been good. We also have a link there to our chat room, which is even older. I started doing this chat room in 1992 or 93, I think. So this chat room is almost 20 years old. But see, the chat rooms aren't like web pages. Chat rooms never get old. They're constantly refreshed. The original moderator of this chat room was a guy some of you may know named Robert Scoble, who's gone on to fame and fortune as a social media guru. Andrew and Vallejo, thank you for your patience. So you're downsizing, you're in a smaller place, an apartment.
Yeah, the kids are out of the house, and I'm downsizing.
I did the same thing. I'm in a studio apartment, and I love it. And you know what? I have a great stereo, and I crank it up, and I have a subwoofer. And so far, I haven't heard any complaints from the neighbors. Maybe they like my music. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I see these panels you can, like, wallpaper up.
Yeah.
And there's also these panels you can put on the walls. I'm wondering how effective they are. Or can you just put, like, rubber under your subwoofer?
That would help, but it would also reduce the woof because it's absorbing some of the sound. So really, a lot of it depends on the construction of the building. An older building with thin walls, it's going to be very difficult. We have a similar situation here at the Tech Guy Labs. There's a restaurant next door, and when we first built the studios here, they used to play rock and roll every evening. So when we put it in, we put in special sound-suppressing drywall. And it has helped a lot. The best, of course, the best sound suppression is an air gap. So if you go into a recording studio or a radio station, you'll notice that the windows are double paned with a actually it's not an air gap, a vacuum between the two panes. You'll notice that they'll have an airlock. They'll have two doors. The floor will be raised. So the idea is all sound is vibration, right? And vibration goes better through solid materials than it does through air or vacuum. Goes the least through vacuum. In fact, in space, no one can hear you scream. I believe that was the tagline for Alien. So now the problem is you can't rebuild your apartment building. So right. You're going to have to do the best you can. There are there's absolutely sound deadening paneling. Some of it has lead in the middle of it because the more dense the material, the less easy it is for vibrations to go through. That's why drywall is so terrible. It just goes right through it. We have used special sound suppressing drywall. We've used air gaps. I have used these lead panels. None of them work perfectly. Some people are saying movers rugs. Yeah, that would work. Shag carpeting on the wall. That would work. The idea is suppress vibration. And that's why rubber would work under your subwoofer, too, because the vibrations from the subwoofer are somewhat damped or absorbed by the rubber because it compresses. The problem is that you want those vibrations. That's what you're listening to. So it's a balance.
Okay.
Yeah. Those things do work, but they're within limits.
Right.
Yeah.
Hey, one other quick question.
Sure.
Where's Marty Sargent?
Oh, the great Martin Sargent. He used to do stuff on the Screensavers. He was our kind of, we called him Mr. Scuzzy. He was the guy who explained, SCSI, by the way. He was the guy who explained stuff, and I just loved him. He's done a couple of shows. He did one called Unscrewed, which is a very funny show about weird stuff on the internet, on Tech TV for some years. He got a job, I'm sorry to say. He's gainfully employed. He's a copywriter. Could be Berlin Silverstein, a very, very well-known ad agency in San Francisco, and he's working. But I keep telling Marty, I said, Marty, I want to do a show with you, and I'm hoping that we will sometime do a show on our podcast network. A lot of the old Tech TV alumni turned to the internet when Tech TV went away, and some of them are here at my podcast network, Twit. And Martin is just, he used to do a show called This Week in Fun that nobody watched, so we had to cancel it. But that happens sometimes. Hey, good luck in your new place, Andrew. I know it's fun, isn't it, setting it up? But then, you know, there are some, if you've been living in a big house where you could crank up the volume, suddenly you got to be a little more careful. So far, I've been lucky, knock on wood. But the building I'm in is steel frame. It's got cast concrete floors. It absorbs sound pretty well. Richard, Big Bar, California, Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Ouch.
Ouch!
Yeah, the switchover.
Yeah, you know, I don't know why. I've mentioned this before. When I pick you up, you'll hear a chong. I don't know why it does that. I guess it's to wake you up in case you fell asleep.
Yeah. Speaking of old Tech TV people, how's Kate doing?
She's great. She married one of our lab rats, Ray Weigel. They moved to Traverse City, Michigan, where she has a web design. They, two of them, have a web design firm. She might even be listening because we're on in Traverse City. Hello, Kate. Kate Patello. And she's also doing a singing. She's a great singer, as you probably know if you ever saw her on the Screensaver. She was my co-host on the Screensavers in the early years.
I watched the Tech TV ever since it was ZDTV.
Yeah, that's when she was on it, ZDTV. So, you know, everybody asks me about her all the time, and I really got to get her on one of our shows. I will do that. I'll make sure I... You know, she kind of got out of the limelight, out of the public eye. She teaches singing and so forth. And I think sometimes, you know, if you've been on TV for a while, you kind of welcome the privacy of being a private person after being a public person. I think that's what happened to Kate.
Well, I'm thinking of starting up a podcast, and I know that you've been doing this for a while, and I was curious, how do you figure out how to charge advertisers? How do you deal with advertisers?
That's a tricky one, which I have not yet solved, but... You know, Richard, if you watch it all, and our network is TWIT, This Week in Tech, and it's at TWIT.TV. Yeah. And so when I first started, it was really more a hobby than a business, and I did it for free, and we asked viewers to send us money to kind of support the bandwidth costs and things like that. People were very generous, but nevertheless, I calculated it was only about 1% or 2% of all the listeners who ever gave any money. And it wasn't enough to build it. It was enough to kind of keep it going, to make it break even. But it certainly wasn't enough to pay me a salary or pay anybody else a salary or to expand. And now we have 25 employees. We have over 30 shows. We have a 10,000-square-foot studio. And all of that happened because partly because of donations. I'm still very grateful. We raised $250,000 to build the studio, for instance. But it cost $1.2 million, so we had to have more, and that came from advertisers. And I'm a big believer. This is what radio is what most broadcast television is. It's ad-supported, advertising-supported media. And I'm a big believer in free media that's supported by ads. There are other ways to do it. There's HBO, where there are no ads, but you pay to watch. And, you know, if my content were as good as HBO's, maybe I would do that too. But it isn't. And so I can't. So what we do advertising, and I think it works. I think it's a good form of broadcasting. I think people, certainly in the U.S., are used to it. And are willing to put up with a small number of ads, especially if they're targeted. The trick is to convince advertisers that it's a good idea. And I'll talk a little bit about how you might be able to do that for yourself in just a bit. Hold on, Richard. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Ozzy says, you pay to watch HBO? Well, maybe not you. What is this paying? How do you pay for things?
All right, the minute physics. So this is a minute, huh?
If you're running a small business, you can't operate at any...
One more, and then we won't do any more Higgs boson stuff. I don't want to bore you.
Fastest two-sided inkjet.
Huh? Oh, I hate pre-roll. This is not only pre-roll, but this is more pre-roll for booze, it looks like.
I can tell you, I love it. The thing's more than just fast.
We won't be showing you that.
That's just half the story.
The tequila pre-roll. I'm having to do with a fireman, a small, smoky pussycat.
Start with the ink.
And I guess now he's going to drink tequila. That's nice. That's responsible.
Color lasers, but the ink.
That's
the
great.
Laser.
I'm not airing it. I'm just talking about it.
Zips out two-sided.
All right, we'll skip the ad now.
Cut back on paper costs up to 50%. Right?
Let's cut to the chase. As of July 4th, 2012, the Higgs boson is the last fundamental piece of the Standard Model of particle physics to be discovered experimentally. But you might ask, why was the Higgs boson included in the Standard Model alongside well-known particles like electrons and photons and quarks?
I don't think this is easier
to understand.
If it
hadn't been discovered back then in the 1970s. Good question. There are two main reasons. First, just like the electron is an excitation in the electron field, the Higgs boson is simply a particle which is an excitation of the everywhere permeating Higgs field. The Higgs field, in turn, plays an integral role in our model for the weak nuclear force. In particular, the Higgs field helps explain why it's so weak. We'll talk more about this in a later video, but even though weak nuclear theory was confirmed
in the
1980s, in the equations,
I like this. It's good, and I refer you to it if you are interested in a more technical explanation of the Higgs boson. This is the channel this is on is Minute Physics, youtube.com/minutephysics. But that one is a more technical explanation. I like the one we saw on It's Okay to Be Smart. I thought that was good.
Sure that people
thank you, sir.
Compensation for the products that they're developing.
Thank you yes. Very much.
Report software piracy.
Software piracy is bad, and you are a bad person for doing it. So don't. And if your boss does it and he fired you and you don't like him, well, call the BSA and we'll narc on him.
Online and search no piracy.
Ooh, this looks good. Thank you, Matthew. Nice big olives. Oh, wasn't that great? I totally did. That was amazing. Chad's saying the conversation with 12-year-old self. Yeah, I reshared that on Google Plus. Yeah. You know, it was Randall that I saw it from. Amazing. So this guy's a filmmaker. That's one of the reasons. I don't know how it happened. He apparently taped himself when he was 12, 20 years ago on video, and then re-edited it to have a conversation with himself. We'll play it after the next break. Every time I hear this, I feel like I should be putting on makeup and getting ready to run on...
All right, Kate, your mic's on.
Screensavers, I'm Kate Patello.
There you go, Kate Patello. It does sound 70s. We wanted it to sound like a 70s cop theme. That was the theme, although it was 1998, so I guess it wasn't so retro at the time. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, a little blast from the past. 8888-ASK-LEO. That's the phone number. Back to the phones we go. Let me see who's been holding on here. How about George Downey, California? You're next. Hi, George.
Hi, how are you, Leo?
I am well. How are you?
Good. Hey, I listen to music a lot on Pandora, but now I wanted to see if I could download music and just keep things on my I have the HTC Thunderbolt, and I know I also want to be able to create some kind of a cloud where I could keep that music also if I get the new Google Galaxy when it comes out, or I think it may be out already.
I love Pandora. Pandora is a basically free, although you can pay for it if you don't want any ads, internet radio station. And the music industry kind of allows it to exist because there's some limitations on it. For instance, you can't pick a song. You pick an artist, and it will make a station out of the artist and then play songs that are not only from that artist but similar to that artist. And you can refine it with thumbs up and thumbs down. You can skip, but you can only skip a few times a day. I think it's 10 times a day if you don't like a song. So the record, remember that any company like Pandora has to do a deal with the devil, a.k.a. the record industry. And that was the compromise the record industry insisted on.
And it, you know what? It works. I think Pandora is one of the most amazing things. I pay for the pro version, and I love it. But you make an interesting point. You can't save it. You can only, it only works when you're online. It works on 3G, but it uses data. It only works when you're online. So you want to have stuff. I presume what you're saying is I want to be able to listen to music when I'm not online.
Well, in the case of Zeb, you're downloading, and if you're on your cell phone, I mean, I have an unlimited data package, but I'm assuming that might disappear as more people start downloading information. I just want to be caught having to pay for it later.
Well, let me tell you about the next step up. And it, now, this is free. If you want free, this is pretty much your choice. There's other good choices like Songza, which is brand new, S-O-N-G-Z-A. It's similar, and I think they have the same kind of deal with the record industry. The way Songza works, though, instead of picking an artist, you pick a mood. But if you want to pick individual songs or you want offline access, you're going to have to pay. Now, what you're going to have to pay, and it's pretty much universal, is $10 a month. And I think that's a pretty good deal. There are a number of services, Rhapsody, Moog, Ardio, and my favorite, Spotify, that allow you to pay for it. You can pick what you want. They have in all cases, they have almost the same selection of music, roughly 19 million songs. And the advantage of these on an Android phone or iPhone 2 is you can say, save this album to my phone. And then when you're offline, you can continue to listen. You have to continue to pay, however, every month, $10, or you won't be able to continue to listen.
Well, the obvious question, if after a year you cancel your subscription?
You can't listen to it. It's gone. So if you want to keep music, you have to buy music. And that means iTunes or Android has its, you know, Google has play.google.com. Amazon has one. These all three of them have cloud storage, so you don't have to store it on your device. But you do have to pay for each song, generally 99 cents, but sometimes more, sometimes less, sometimes 79 cents.
What if you move to a tablet, let's say the new Galaxy, would you be able to download?
Yeah,
as long as you have.
when you buy digital songs, it's just like buying a CD or an album, a record, an LP. You own it, and you have to somehow manage it, but you own it. So all three, Amazon, Google, and Apple, now have cloud-based storage, so you don't have to have all of your music on your device. You can open up your device and say, hey, that song that's in the cloud, put that on my device. Okay. I like all three and use all three. I think that Amazon is pretty darn good. It works on Android phones. Google Play is good, too. The reason I use all three is all of them have deals and sales. Amazon and iTunes will have free songs almost every day. Google often has very affordable songs. So if you have an Android phone, you have Google Play on your phone already. So it's just a question of going to the music section and looking at what they have.
Google Play is different than Spotify.
It is. So there's three levels. There's the free level, which is Pandora and Songza. You don't get to pick songs. It's just radio stations. There's the intermediate level where you pay $10 a month. You have an unlimited selection, but you must continue to pay to have that unlimited selection. When you stop paying, it goes away. If you want to own music, and Apple, by the way, is a firm believer, the people, they never have offered a subscription model. They believe people want to pay 99 cents and they want to own that song for life. If you want to pay and own songs for life, the Amazon, Google, and Apple are the three big players in this. There are many others.
So that would be the one that you referenced, Google.
Well, Google Play is already on your phone, play.google.com on the website. They have the reason I use all three of them, I don't prefer any one of them, is they have deals. All three of them have free records or cheap records, and they'll have deals. Right now, Google Play has a sale on classic jazz from Coltrane, Miles Davis, Louis Armstrong for $3.99 per album. That's a good deal. So it's a good way to build your collection. Now, this is a case where you pay for it once. It's uncopy protected. You could put it on any device, and you own it for life. So if that's what you like, then
That's what I prefer, but I like Pandora where you can pick the genre of music you're interested in.
I love Pandora. I listen to Pandora, too. You know what? I have a Pandora membership. I have a Spotify membership. I find myself less and less buying music with Spotify because my son's the same way. You know, I used to give my kids a $10 a month allowance. That's one CD on iTunes, right? One CD a month. And my son Henry, who loves music, said, wait a minute, $10 a month, I can listen to any CD on Spotify. And so I think increasingly people are realizing that these subscription services are really the best deal in music. I don't know if they're a great deal for musicians. I think from a musician's point of view, they'd rather you bought the music on Amazon, Google, or iTunes because they get more money.
My son also recommends Spotify.
Yeah.
Hey, I have one.
By the way, Spotify has on iOS, not on Android yet, but I'm sure they'll soon have it, has iOS-like radio stations now where you select an artist or a genre and it'll put together a list of music for you.
Oh, good. That's
I really like Spotify, I have to say. But I still use Pandora. In fact, my alarm clock's a Pandora station. When I get home in the evening, I put on Pandora. I like somebody picking the music for me. I like the idea of it's not something I already know about. It's not something I bought. It's something I haven't heard before, and maybe I then will buy it. So it's good to have both.
Yeah, I agree. Last question. On the new tablet that's coming out, the Galaxy from Google, none of these new tablets will also act as a telephone where you don't have to carry a telephone and a tablet around everywhere you go?
I beg to differ.
Oh, good.
They're not a traditional telephone like a cell phone is, but if you have 3G or Wi-Fi access, you can use Skype. There are many programs like Skype, Tango, Voxer. And I found a new program, actually a new piece of hardware that somebody asked me about last week. I bought it, and I've been using it, called Obi-Hi, that lets you use Google Voice on your phone. Now it really is like a phone number because Google Voice gives you a real phone number. And it's free. The Obi-Hi device is about $40, obihai.com. You hook it up to your internet access at home, and it becomes a Google Voice phone number for your phone. I'm very happy with this Obi-Hi. I really like it. So once you set it up, you have to have a Google Voice account, and that's free. I should talk about this when we come back, because somebody asked about it. So you can put Obi-Hi on the Galaxy Tab 7. And then that becomes your Google Voice phone. And because Google Voice is a real phone number, U.S. only, yeah. Sorry. Apologize. Oh, good. Let's get Chris on the line here. Thank you, Chris. Thanks for reminding me. So the way we do this, this is kind of fun. I'll show you how I do this. I use VNC to go into the basement to our Skype machine. And there it is. And then I call Chris. This is a different machine. This is the Skype machine in the basement. And I'm going to make him full screen as soon as he answers. Hi, Chris. There he is.
Hello, sir.
Hey. Welcome. Let me make you full screen. And I'm going to right click and hide my video so I don't see myself. Then I'm going to close screen sharing.
This is a complicated setup with VNC.
It's not that. You know what? It's cool. It's amazing I can do this.
Amazing. I'm 600, well, 400 or 500 miles away from home right now, and I can VNC into my computer there and do stuff.
Yeah, it's pretty. Where are you?
Hey, I'm right now in Hannover, northern Germany.
All right. What you doing there?
Well, that's where my fiancé lives, and that's where I live now.
Oh, you've moved.
But I still have my studio down in Tübingen.
You got to fix that. How far is Hanover from Tübingen?
7 hours by car.
Oh, my God. Autobahn.
So that means 7 hours.
It's like you live in Alaska and you work in California. What's wrong with you?
Well, we're sorting things out.
All right. So you're going to...
This is the first step.
Are you going to move to Hanover eventually?
Yeah, I've actually pretty much moved here already. Good. By the way, I cannot see you. I see a screen there.
Well, you can see yourself now, right?
No,
you see a screen?
I see a screen and lower third, episode 890, The Tech Guy.
What is he seeing? Let me launch the server again and check that out.
Yeah.
We changed the input to the... I see that. I can't control that. You'll have to fix that, Burke. He's seeing like playback.
He's seeing HP...
playback in the TriCaster.
I'm seeing an HP laptop for $299.
Yeah, that's like an hour ago on the show.
What?
You keep watching, in an hour you'll see yourself.
Okay. Oh wow! Time echoes.
It's amazing.
Could be another episode.
How you're seeing that.
Well, I don't know. It's nice though. I mean, It's not moving. It's okay. By the way, I want to talk about very simply talk about depth of field today. I know we did it already, but I did a workshop on the weekend, and I just noticed how important it is to people.
What should I restart?
Well, as long
Skype?
As you can hear me.
Turn it off and turn it on? Okay. Turn off video. Turn on video. Still frozen. It's like he's getting... I wonder if the Skype machine needs to be restarted. You don't really need to see me.
Yeah, as long as you guys can hear me, it's good.
Turn off video. Turn on video. Same thing. It's what's being
it's
fed
like
to
a
the...
Windows computer.
It is a Windows computer.
Oh, maybe that explains... Oh, no, sorry. That was not nice.
Don't show your bigotry.
Oh, well.
Everybody's making faces at you, but you can't see it.
Okay, I don't care. I've had faces been made to me over the entire weekend by workshop participants, so...
What was your workshop?
I'm used to it now. Photography. Photo workshop about general stuff, beginner level stuff. That's what I want to talk about.
Hold on a sec. Do I have a billboard, sir?
Yeah, let's do a DSL Extreme billboard here. Close my eyes, if she can see me down. If she can see me breaking down, maybe she turned
up. This portion of the Tech Guy Show is brought to you by my internet service provider, DSL Extreme, for high-speed internet at an amazing price. Call 866, the number 2, GetNet, to get DSL Extreme. Chris Marquardt, our photo guy, is here. He is the host of a great podcast called Tips from the Top Floor, tfttf.com. He's also at chrismarquardt.com, does workshops. In fact, he's in Hanover, Germany, where he just completed kind of a digital photography basics workshop. Welcome, Chris.
Hey, how's it going? I just did a two-day workshop together with my co-host on my German workshop, on my German podcast about... Yeah, basics, getting things right, using how to use the equipment for your best pictures, and one of the things that keeps coming up on these workshops, sometimes even on more advanced ones, is very basic stuff, and that's what I want to talk about today. And it's depth of field.
Depth of field.
Depth of field. And the first question is, what is field, right? What is that field?
You're not going to talk about the Higgs boson, are you?
No, it's not the Higgs field.
Okay,
no.
Okay.
It's the depth of field.
Okay.
The field that we're talking about here in photography is the field of acceptable sharpness in a picture. So
focus. It's focus.
It's pretty much focus, and then the further you go away, it goes out of focus, and the closer you are from where you focus, it's also out of focus. The problem is always that with like smaller cameras, with pocket cameras, it's harder to get shallow depth of field. That's what a lot of, let's say, portrait photographers are looking for. They want the depth of field to be shallow. They want the background out of focus. They want just the person in focus. Now, it's really much, much easier the bigger the sensor in your camera. Like if you have a DSLR, it's fairly easy. If you have a system camera, an electronic viewfinder, with interchangeable lens camera, those in the middle kind of sensors, those are fairly good for that. But there are a few reasons why I want to have it. One is to show depth in a picture. You know, like a camera has only one eye. We have two eyes. So we see a stereo picture, the camera doesn't. And that loss of depth that you have in photography, you want to recreate that in some way, especially in any picture you want to recreate that depth.
Now, one thing that this doesn't come up much for a lot of photographers because they're using those point-and-shoot cameras, and there isn't a lot of depth of field. Everything seems to be in focus with most of those cameras, right?
That is the problem with a smaller point-and-shoot, more compact cameras. And to get this shallow depth of field, there are a few ways you can still achieve some of that. And it will help you. Will help the viewer of the picture and focus their attention.
It tells them what to look at.
What's in focus in a picture? That's what's important, and that means that what's important, you kind of want that in focus as a photographer. So you want the rest kind of out of focus sometimes to get
a bit of more to make things more important in a picture. And it's pretty much a creative tool, right? So here are some ways to achieve that. The depth of field has to do with three main factors in your camera. First of all, and I think a lot of people who read something about photography might know, that's the aperture. Is this iris in your camera. Every camera has that. The aperture, that's the hole in the camera. The light comes in through in the lens. And the larger that hole is, the more shallow your depth of field goes. So, interestingly enough, it's connected with the number, with the so-called aperture number. And a small aperture number means a large hole. It means shallow depth of field. So if your camera can do, let's say, f2.0, compact cameras sometimes do that. You want to shoot at f2.0, not at f4.0 or 5.6 or f8 or f11, the bigger numbers. You want smaller numbers. So you might be able to set your camera to a mode where it allows you to control the aperture, and then you just make that a very small number. So this is the first factor. And this is true, by the way, for all cameras. Also, your DSLR will do that. So you have a smaller aperture, you have a larger, more shallow depth of field. The second one is the focal length. If you shoot wide angle, which is a short focal length, a small number of millimeters, like a 24 millimeter or an 11 millimeter, you will have a lot of depth of field. You will have everything in focus. But if you shoot at a longer focal length, if you zoom in, if you have a zoom lens and you zoom in, let's say at 100 millimeters, 150, 200 millimeters, you get shallow depth of field. Things start going out of focus. You can focus in more on your subject. And again, that works for any kind of camera, compact cameras, bigger cameras. Those rules are pretty much physical rules of optics. They apply to all these cameras. And then the third factor, that's the distance. If you're far away from something, you have a lot of depth of field. If you get close in, as close as you can, you get less depth of field. So when you have a compact camera, zoom all the way in, try to get as close as possible. If you can, open up the aperture and you will see shallow depth of field. You'll be able to get things in the picture in focus and other things out of focus. So it's a real simple trick if you try these three different things.
And it really does. It's funny when you get a camera that is capable of doing this, of having something in sharp focus and then having a background in kind of a softer focus, it really makes your pictures look more professional. We subconsciously associate this depth of field with professional. It's the same thing in your video, by the way, when you shoot video like that.
Absolutely. Works the same way.
Yeah. Movies have, if you look, it's something we're kind of unaware of until you actually look for it. But if you watch a movie, it's not unusual to see the main character in perfect focus, and then the background kind of in a softer focus. It draws your attention to the main character, and it's something we've used to seeing, but only in professional media. And so this is a good, quick way of making your pictures more effective and more professional looking. That's one of the big Absolutely. Jumps you get by going to a DSLR.
True. Makes it very easy.
Yeah. Chris Marquardt talks about photography at his podcast and in his workshops and I think pretty much all the time at chrismarquardt.com, chrismarquardt.com. We got that in our show notes, techguylabs.com. And are we working on an assignment?
We have an assignment going. It's the barbecue assignment. And we could use a few more entries. I think it's too hot in the United States right now for people to
nobody's
to go
taking
out
the camera.
Fire. Not really. So yeah, it's barbecue, and we'll have it up for another 1 or 2 weeks, and then we're going to do a review, pick the best three, and look at them here on the show.
So here's how it works. You can have depth of field or not if you want to do this. Take a picture that illustrates the concept barbecue. I don't know what that is. We don't know. This is your chance to be creative with it. You could take that picture and then upload it to Flickr. It's free to join, FLICKR.com. It's the word Flickr without the E. It's a Yahoo property, so you already have an account if you have a Yahoo account. If not, it's easy to make one. And then upload that picture to the Tech Guy group. So once you create your Flickr account, click the Groups tab at the top. Search for Tech Guy, two words. You'll know it's a Tech Guy group. There's 2,500 photos in there, 10,000 members, and all the new ones have to do with barbecues. So upload that picture. Put barbecue, BBQ in the tag. That's what we're looking for, the letters BBQ in the tag. And Chris is going to pick three representative pictures, talk about them in a couple of weeks on the show. It's not a contest. It's not a competition. It's just for fun. Just an excuse, really, to go out and take more pictures. And that's what Chris is all about. Hey, Chris, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Absolutely.
Tips from the top floor. Highly recommended. Had you have advertisements? Let me ask you this, since we were talking about advertising on podcasts. Do you have advertisements on your podcasts?
I have a sponsor for my German podcast, so that, which we had for 3 years now, and is an accessory, photo accessory.
But you probably don't make more than enough to kind of defray your expenses, I would guess.
Yeah, pretty much. It's not really high volume. The podcast. if you get into podcasting to make money to quit your day job, you'll have to work really, really hard.
Don't. Really, most people do it either just for fun or, as Chris does, as promotion for your other businesses as a photographer and workshops. It's rare that anybody makes a living podcasting. Hey, thanks, Chris. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Good job, Mr. Marquardt.
We had a bit of a glitch in between. I think I had a bit of an audio hiccup here, but...
Sounded fine at this end. Didn't hear a thing.
All right, cool.
I heard you kind of hesitating and like something was going wrong, but we didn't hear it.
For years, I've talked about ESET's Nod 32 is
going really nice for us here.
Very, very good. So I will do my best. I will be back next week. And
okay.
But we only have like 7 or 8 pictures for the barbecue assignment at this point. So I want a couple more.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm spoiled. I know. We're spoiled.
Okay. I will make sure we get a couple more.
Thank you so much. Okay.
All right. Hey, thanks. Take care, Chris.
Talk to you again next week. Alrighty. Bye.
Bye-bye. So we're going to have to restart the TriCaster, apparently, to fix that glitch.
We can do that. We have the means.
Meanwhile, let me change the background.
Protection you won't even notice. But don't take my word back. For it. Try it free for 30 days.
So the best thing that happened that we did in the studio was we put in a Blackmagic, a great expense, I might add, a video router. A router is just like a switchboard. So, you know, in the old movies where you'd have the operator sitting there saying, let me get your party. And so she'd have a plug in one hole, that's your phone, and a plug in another hole, that's their phone. And she'd take it and she'd plug it in, and now you're connected. There's a wire leading from your phone to their phone. That's actually how, believe it or not, how the phone system still works. It just does it electronically. So in the early days of video and radio studios, it's exactly what you'd have. They called it a patch bay, where you take the output of one thing and put it into the input of another. Well, if you think about it, we have more than 30 cameras. We have every computer has output. And we often want to take that output and put it into something else. So, for instance, my TriCaster has 8 different cameras it can use, 8 different inputs it can use. So we pick from the 30 cameras, we pick 8 of the 30 to put in there. And then how do we do it? We do it with this video router. Now, this is a really cool one. It has 72 inputs. So think of a big patch bay. 72 out and 144 in. So that means we have 72 sources of video. And we, with 30 cameras and a bunch of computers, we've actually maxed it out. And then 144 places we could put those. So you can take one output and put it into multiple places. So that's what this thing that I was just using does. The neat thing about this is it's a virtual patch bay. It's in the basement. There are no connectors or plugs. It's done via Wi-Fi. So I have, it's the Blackmagic Broadcast Video Hub. You can see these are all the output choices. And then into any given output, in this case, I'm going to change what the output is number 12. My monitor right here is number 12, Leo Monitor Desk. So I'm going to switch that. Right now it's Skype 1. That's what Chris was on. But I can do any of these inputs. You see, there's 72 inputs. So I could take any of these things and put them into my... So for instance, if I want to put the iMac into the monitor behind me, now my desktop from the iMac is in the monitor, what you were just looking at. If I wanted to put the output... You want to get really weird? All right. I could take the camera that you're looking at right now and put it into this monitor. Yeah, what do you think will happen? Got a guess? What will happen? It'll be endless? All right, let's see. That's his guess. Whoops, that's the wrong thing. I let go too soon. I want to put camera 2. Leo single. What is Leo floor? I don't even know. Did somebody change these? Here it is. Leo, two shot. So I'm going to put my two shot into there. Into there. Into there. Into there. Into there. Into there. So you were right. I can hit myself.
Nearly 14 billion years ago, expansion started. Wait, the earth began to cool, the autotrophs began to drool. Neanderthals developed tools, we built a wall, we built the pyramids. Math, science, history, unraveling the mystery that all started with a big bang.
Whoa! Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888, ask Leo is the number. Yeah, I'm sure they'll explain the Higgs boson on an upcoming episode of the Big Bang. And then everybody will know that the greatest discovery, the scientific discovery of this century, happened this week, was announced this week. So we were talking about podcast advertising, how you can make money in podcasting. I think Chris Marquardt said it right. He said, don't do it to make money. Do it because you love it, because it's fun. It's great to create media, though. You know, it used to be that if you wanted to do a radio show, you had to find a radio station and convince them that you deserved a radio show. And believe me, as somebody who, coming out of college, wanted to do radio, that wasn't easy. I found the smallest, cheesiest, low-rent radio station I could find. And even then, I had to talk to them for months to convince them that, yeah, they should put me on the air. And guess what they put me on the air? They put me on the air the middle of the night, Saturday, Sunday. Midnight, yeah. Of course they did, because they didn't know me from Adam. I remember the program director saying, you're a diamond in the rough, Laporte, but we're going to give you a chance.
I'd worked in college radio. I know all about
it. You're a diamond in the rough. So he put me on midnight Sunday, and I got an hour of my own airtime, and then the rest of the time I was running reel-to-reel tapes of religious services all night long. But I got that hour. I got my foot in the door. Now, all you need is a computer, a headset. You've got the internet. You can make a radio. You can even do TV because of YouTube. It's free. You can do anything you want. Just don't expect to make money at it. Nobody's going to pay you to do it. Do it because you love it. The good news is it doesn't cost you much to do it. It just costs you your time. You put your time into it. You make something good. There is always a possibility of making money. I mean, if you look at YouTube, there's dozens of people. Annoying Orange, Fred Figglehoffer, whatever his name is. These are people who just did it for fun at first, but found an audience and now are doing really, really well. So that's the opportunity. Getting advertising is a little more tricky because you have to convince an advertiser. It's even harder to convince them to give you money to do ads on your programming. So you have to have a large enough audience. They're not going to give you money for five people. You have to have a big audience. You have to you have the infrastructure to do it. They have to trust you. Independent media is not, you know, it's a little more, it's easier if you're ABC, CBS, NPR, ESPN, if you're well-known, if you're a public. And that's why, by the way, notice most of the successful podcasts come from existing media because they have the connections. They're known. They're a known quantity. My independent podcast network, TWiT, is one of the few independent networks that actually is profitable. And it's taken us years to convince advertisers we're the real thing and we have a good audience and it's worth it. So I wouldn't start doing this on that basis. And selling your own ads is very difficult. It can take more time than doing the media. So the opportunity really is to get on something like YouTube where they sell the ads. You don't make as much money, but if you get a large audience, you can make quite a good living. I also was going to, I'm kind of filling it, following up on stuff that we had started. I was going to mention this Obihi, which somebody called last week to ask me about. And I said, well, I've never heard of it. I ordered one on Amazon. It was $37, I think. They make three different devices, the Obihai. They make the 100, the 110, and the 202. The 100 is what you probably want if all you want to do is take your Google Voice or your other VoIP system and make it into a phone line. That's what I did. I plugged the Obi at home. I plugged it into the internet and plugged it into a phone handset. And then I connected it up with my Google Voice. Now, Google Voice is nice because it's free. It gives you free calls to anywhere in the U.S. and Canada, at least through the end of this year anyway. And very inexpensive, pennies a call, phone calls to overseas. Very low international rates. Now, the caller was asking, well, what about my Nexus 7, my new Google tablet? Well, Obihi also makes apps for iPhone and Android that will let you make phone calls using your Obi device. So you're right. The Nexus 7 doesn't, in the U.S. anyway, have telephone capability, but you get one of these little boxes at home that connects you to the Obi network. You get a Google Voice account, and then you get the Android app. And now you basically have what's called a soft phone. You have phone capability on your Nexus tablet. I'm very impressed by this little device. I don't have a regular landline phone service. I use this. Quality's good. There's no monthly fee because Google Voice is free. And the Obi High is about $40, very inexpensive. Now, you are relying on Obi providing the back end. The servers have to keep running. If they went out of business, it would stop working. So that is a little risk, but I figured at $40, no big deal. If I get a year or two out of it, this will be great. The main thing to understand, and I think they're very clear about it on the website, is no 911. None at all. So this is not an emergency phone. And for many of you, it's probably a good idea to have a landline with a phone on it, preferably one that does not require power. You know, the old school phones, you just plug into the wall, you don't plug into the power, so that if there is an emergency, you can reach 911. That is a good reason to have a landline. But these Obis are pretty amazing. I've been very happy. I can't remember the name of the caller who asked me about it. But I would highly recommend it. I'm kind of amazed, really. Back to the phones. Kathy is in Maryland. Hey, Kathy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hello. Wait a minute. I've lost control of my computer.
Hi, Kathy.
Yes, hi.
Hi.
I wanted to say it's really great to speak with you. And first off, I really like your current theme song. I'll be sorry to lose it.
Oh, we're not losing it. I can't find anything better anyway. I'm just joking around. You mean that one that begins the show? Da-na-na-na-na-na. You like that?
Yes, I sure do. And in fact, I put it on my iPhone.
It's not your ringtone, is it?
Uh-huh.
It is? Wow, I love that. Now, I wonder, how did you get it? Did you record it off the radio?
I recorded it off of YouTube.
Oh, it's on YouTube. Great. Yeah, a Hollywood composer, very talented guy named Ashley Witt wrote that for me. And he does a lot of movies and commercials and TV shows, works a lot with Tim Burton. Really good composer. Well, I'm glad you like it.
Yeah, and otherwise I wanted to ask, I'm blind, and I'm currently using Windows XP, and I know at some point I'll have to switch to another.
Yeah, Windows XP is going to, what they call end of life. In other words, Microsoft will stop offering security updates in just a year or two.
Right. Well, you've been saying that you how much you like Windows 7, but I had heard with Windows 8 that it has more of a built-in screen reader capability, which I never heard about for Windows 7.
That is a very good point. Accessibility will probably be much better on Windows, or at least I expect it to be much better on Windows 8. That's a great question. I don't have any experience with accessibility. That's what we call it, when you know the ability for people with different abilities to use an operating system. The most difficult one on a graphical operating system is if you're blind. Because you can't look at the windows, you can't close windows, you can't click with a mouse because you can't see it. So blind people often use something called screen readers that will tell you what you're looking at. They'll read you messages. Yeah. Have you used a screen reader before, Kathy?
Yeah, most definitely. I use something called Window Eyes, and I use JAWS at work.
Yeah, JAWS is the big one. That's the well-known one.
Yeah, well, it was just a point that I thought I'd mention for people since they might not know that Windows 8 would have more of a built-in one. Not that they'd want to switch over just yet, because it might not be optimal, but I just wondered if you knew about it, because I heard that Windows 7 just had maybe a glorified version of Narrator,
right,
which has, you know, helps if you need filling in, you know, if you lose your screen reader capability. But
this was a high priority for Microsoft. In fact, thanks to the chat room, I have a link to the Building Windows 8 blog. Steven Sinofsky, the guy in charge on Valentine's Day this year, wrote a post about enabling accessibility. He said the goals of Windows 8 are to improve the assistive technologies that are components of Windows and to provide a good experience with the Metro-style UI. You know, this tablet UI they're using is even less navigable
for blind people than the old UI. Provide developer tools that have baseline accessibility built in so that accessible apps are available in the store, and to encourage assistive technologies vendors like JAWS to adopt Windows 8 and build upon the accessibility scenarios. So I agree. I think they're going to go one step better than Narrator, which is the built-in screen reader on Windows 7. They say, we redesigned Narrator to improve its performance so it quickly reads what you've selected. We've added more languages and voices, more features. So Narrator's still in there. But yes, I think that my sense is it is much better, Kathy.
Yeah, well, great. Well, thanks so much.
Thanks for the tip. I appreciate it. I'm glad you like our theme. Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy. More to come right after local news. Have I ever been to Tracks Bar and Grill? That's in our neighborhood, isn't it?
Tracks? It's summertime. I don't have to tell you that.
Have you ever been there? Oh, that's the one that says no damn big trucks allowed.
Right.
Right. The parking lot has a giant sign that says no big trucks allowed here. This means you. So I wouldn't go there if you're a trucker. Or if you do, leave your truck behind. So Sufjan Stevens, Chicago. Do you think that sounds like my theme song? Let's hear. Similar. This is very similar.
I fell in love again. All things go, all things go. Drove to Chicago. All things know, all things know. We sold our clothes to the state. I don't mind.
It's good. I like that. 2005 album. It's not the same. It's similar. Hey, I want to talk a little bit about my friends at ShareFile briefly. This is how I share or send large files to the radio stations. You know, I record commercials ahead of time, radio station tracks and stuff. And I used to use the other guy. And you know who the other guys are in this space. Well, many of us used to attach files to emails, right? And that's really a bad way to go. You get bounce backs. You can't send big files. I've said for years, don't use attachments. You're getting people used to the idea of opening things that could potentially be viruses. Of course, when you send something in email, anybody along the way, and usually there's half a dozen servers along the way, can see it. So it's not secure. So there is a better way, and this is ShareFile.com. And I started using this as how I share stuff with the radio stations, and now I use it for everything. First of all, let me log into my ShareFile account. One of the nice things is it's branded. So it's got our Twit logo on it and so forth. This is, and I have a desktop client as well, but I'm showing you the web interface. So this is the browsing the files, right? But let's say I want to send these to these. Here's two commercials. And I want to send these to somebody. I click the send button. You could do this also. There's an Outlook plugin, so it does look like email. Now, there's two ways. I could send the email, blah, blah, blah. But I like to, this is another way. I can get a link. They don't need to have a ShareFile account. They don't need to log in. They will get a link in the email. I get, and this is your all options, but I can have that ShareFile email me when the item's been downloaded. I can say they've got to give me a name and email, which helps with tracking. I can have it expire anything from never to a year later. I say a week because I don't want them to download these ads when they're done. I could say how many times. I give them unlimited in case they screw it up. But you could say anything from 1 to 10 times. And then when you press send files, you're going to get a link. This is a unique link. And I'll show you what it looks like when they click that link in their email. They don't need to sign up for anything. Here's the files. It's very straightforward. They just click download and it downloads it. This is a great way. Instead of sending attachments, of sharing large files, files of almost any size, huge files, I think 10 gigabytes is the limit. You track their downloads. You set access controls. They've got great support on their end, and you can try this free for 30 days right now.
ShareFile.com. Our offer code is TechGuy for this. So when just go to ShareFile.com, click the Try It Free button, and then the promo code is TechGuy. And this is secure, HIPAA compliant, compliant with all federal regulations. It's really a good way. If you have to, in business nowadays, we're always sharing large files. If you have to share files, you see this, I can manage users, by the way. You have an address book. It's just really great. Really great. You can request files. You can have public files. You can have distribution groups. I mean, on and on and on. The things, the kinds of things that you do all the time. ShareFile.com. Click the Try It Free button. The promo code TechGuy will give you 30 days free. No. And James is asking in the chat room, does the other person have to sign up? No. That's what I like about it. You can email them this link. You could try it yourself right now. That's the link. Well, it's kind of a long, weird link, but there it is. Go ahead. Write that down and try it yourself. You know what? I know people do because every time I do this ad, I get an email saying, anonymous, just downloaded your file. It's like, okay, go ahead, download the files. You'll get, this is what you get without signing in. And you get the branding. So it's very, I love it. ShareFile.com. Click the Try It Free button and the offer code, the promo code is Leo. I'm sorry, it's not. It's Tech Guy. Tech Guy. And it's from Citrix. Did I mention that? Tell you, there's an example of an advertiser who started working with Twit, the podcasts, really, I think in the second or third year. They had been advertising on the radio show for a long time, so I knew them. In fact, they advertised on the, I think I knew them since Tech TV. They've always been big supporters. They were the Expert City division, which was something Citrix acquired. But that we used Expert City on the screensavers. And there's an example of an advertiser that has not only, you know, supported the podcast early, but got such good results. All of their products now, and Citrix has a huge line of products, are advertising on the podcast because it works. The hard thing, it's always the case, is to get them on in the first place. But once you get them on, if it works for them, it's hard to get them off. Not that I would want to. But really, that's the key. It's got to produce results, bottom line. And, you know, one of the things that does happen from time to time is they'll advertise on one of our shows and don't get results from that show. And so there's, you know, sometimes, you know, we've canceled some shows recently. There's two reasons why you might get canceled. One is nobody's listening. You know, we don't want to do shows that nobody wants. So if it's a very small, if it's just a few thousand people, we just say, okay, we get it. That was a mistake. But the other thing is sometimes if a show just, if it doesn't work, mostly that's because it's so small, usually. But these guys try, and so you'll hear some of our shows just don't have advertisers. That's, these guys will always try them, and then if it just doesn't work, they're not going to, you got to work. You got to work for the advertisers. Not that we ever design our shows around advertisers or change the contents to appease that. We don't do that. We just try to do the best shows we can. And you know what? We've got the best audience in the world. And you guys, your support for our advertisers, we try to, it really is picking the right advertisers for the audience. You know, we only do advertisers that we know and use and can recommend wholeheartedly. And then it has to be stuff that you might be interested in or just not a good fit. We just recently turned down, I won't say the name, but a dating site wanted to advertise. And I said, no, we're not going to do it because I don't think it's a good fit for our audience. So I actually turn down money all the time from advertisers because it has to be a good fit. I don't want to clutter up our airwaves with stuff that you wouldn't be interested in. I don't know. Are you interested in a dating site? Maybe I made a mistake. Hey, put your hand down, young man. This one's called the Romantic Social Network. Yeah, I just thought, you know, just didn't feel right to me. I know you guys are all lonely, but I just wasn't comfortable.
Leo, is that your cell phone? Do you need to turn it off?
I get it. What was her name? Kathy? Kathy, your cell phone's ringing. Kathy, your cell phone's ringing. No, that's mean. Kathy, your cell phone's ringing. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hour number three of the Tech Guy Show, 8888 Ask Leo. Just a funny thing just happened on the Twitter. I don't know if I should... I guess a guy named Earl just joined Twitter. And he tweeted, you know, Twitter asks you at the on the Twitter webpage, what are you doing, right? And you're supposed to say. So he says, he must have just joined. He says, what am I doing? I could be watching Leo Laporte's live stream. Then apparently his mom was watching. Because her response is, and guess what else you could be doing before I call in a bulldozer to clean out your room? Love you, Mom. Oh, Mom. just a little tip on the Twitter. Everything you tweet is public. Earl, I would clean your room if I were you. I think Mom has chosen the nuclear option. A little Twitter story. I got to save that. That is hysterical. honey. Now, this is modern times. When Mom is tweeting you to clean your room, now we know. Now we are in the modern age, ladies and gentlemen. 8888, Ask Leo. That's my phone number. You can clean your room and listen to the Tech Guy, you know. In fact, I think a lot of you do that, right? You're doing your chores. You're getting around town. You're doing shopping, whatever, on the weekend. And listen to the Tech Guy. It's a perfect match. Makes cleaning your room so much easier. Sally, Lake Balboa, California. Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy. Hi, Sally.
Hi, Leo. Love your show.
Thank you.
I listen to it and I always learn something. I'm not a big techie person, but I've got the Carbonite on my computer.
Great.
And my question is, why, if it's going to save all my files, is it also going to save a virus if I get infected?
Oh, that's a very, very, very good question. Do backups back up viruses? Yes.
It will.
Well, it doesn't know, so it will. Now, here's the good news. Viruses are always programs. So in order for you to get infected, really, you have to run a program. Now, it turns out that occasionally a data file can contain a virus. And I'll give you a couple of examples. Adobe Reader, you know, a lot of us have that to read PDF files. Reader has had in the past... They've mostly patched it, but that's had in the past a bug that allowed a bad guy to create a PDF file. Now, that's a pure document file, a PDF file that was malcrafted in such a way that when it was run through Adobe Reader, not any other PDF reader, but through Adobe Reader, the guy knew that there was flaws in Adobe Reader, and he made the this is very clever, by the way, made the PDF so that it would, in fact, infect the machine. So if you had two things, one, this malcrafted PDF and you were backing it up, and you had an unupdated version of Adobe Reader, then you would be backing up not really the virus, but the trigger for the virus, the thing that could make the virus infect your machine if you should run it. That seems unlikely, especially since this PDF doesn't really contain any data. It seems unlikely that you'd save it. The way they would use this in most cases is you put it a website out there, get you to go to that website that automatically loads this PDF without your knowledge, and then it triggers the Adobe Reader, blah, blah, blah. In general, you're not backing up programs, right? You're backing up data. You're backing up the stuff you have that's yours, that's only yours. That stuff does not contain viruses.
Okay. So I can, I assume since I do run Mac, I probably am not going to get too many viruses.
Oh, yeah, you don't have to worry at all. The Mac viruses that are out there, none of them are this data file format. They're all of them actual programs. So you wouldn't be backing them up.
All right, well, you put my mind at ease. Yeah. So.
It is something to be aware of, though. You know, if you get infected and you reinstall Windows, as I recommend, or reinstall OS X, as I recommend, and then restore your data, you could be restoring something that has potential for malware in it. That's why we generally recommend that after you do the restore, you do a virus scan on your data.
Okay.
Just to make sure that you didn't restore something bad.
Good.
I'm glad you asked, Sally. That's actually a great question. I think people don't often think about that. Sure, the backup but it backs up whatever you tell it to back up. And if you say back up a file that's a virus, it'll back it up. It doesn't know. Might be a nice feature. I'll talk to David at Carbonite, the CEO there, the founder, David Friend, to have, and you know, for all I know, they may be doing this. I should find out. Have a virus scanner running at Carbonite
Oh, I know why they don't. Because in order to do that, they'd actually have to be able to look into your files, right? That's how a virus scanner works, and they don't want to do that. They want to protect your privacy. That's probably what's going on there. So as a result, that means it's up to you. You need to scan your own files when you get it back. Hi, Doc Mark. Mark Sekoenig from Syracuse, New York. Hi, Mark.
It's me. Chris Marquardt said something was really valid a few minutes ago.
You're an eye doctor, so you know this stuff.
Yes. He discussed pupil size or aperture, f-stop, in a camera, and when one has a smaller opening, we have more depth of field, depth of focus. So for those of us who have already worn or ought to be wearing correction, whether we're farsighted or nearsighted or have astigmatism, if we hit the point of saying, you know, I'm having more trouble seeing at night, it's because we have a larger opening. So if we don't have the best focus, the best glasses or contacts or just eyes, in the dark we have a bigger pupil, so we lose depth of focus.
Wow. And I did not think of that. That means so when your focal plane is very shallow. You can only see something in one particular area in focus. Everything right. else loses focus.
So when people say, I'm having more trouble seeing at night, it usually means time to get to the eye doc because your prescription isn't as good. You're getting better depth simply by virtue of small pupils with bright light.
Is this the same thing? This happens to me when I'm in a restaurant and I'm trying to read a menu. If it's a dark restaurant, I have a much harder time than if I shine a bright light on it.
Absolutely. I use the light on my iPhone 4S a lot.
When you have a little flashlight.
I use Big Magnify, which will magnify it and light it, but usually it's just a little more light.
Good idea.
And we see better. That's not what I called about, though.
I love that, though. Thank you, Mark, for explaining
sure.
that. Yeah.
I have two questions.
Yes.
One, since iDisc just went away, or .Mac and all that.
Yes.
Did we also lose at the same time back to my Mac?
No.
Because at work, I no longer see my home computers from work
no.
computer.
You need okay. to sign into iCloud now, though, and turn it on.
Okay.
So that is a feature of iCloud. The things we mostly lost was iDisk. You mentioned iDisk.
Yep.
And the galleries that were part of MobileMe, the MobileMe galleries.
I had a bunch. Well, I downloaded them.
Yeah. Those two functionalities are not in iCloud. You don't have iDisk and you don't have galleries, but you do have Back to My Mac. So if you log into your iCloud account right now, you'll see at radar screen. I'm sorry, that's Lost My Mac. It must be in the settings. I'll have to log in
okay.
and see.
I still have some G4s and G5s from my old office, separate from my MacBook Air, and at home we have...
Oh, you know, that's different. In that case, I'll have to investigate, but that's because those can't use iCloud.
Right.
I bet you no longer have Back to My Mac.
Okay, and then I have my big question.
Yes.
I have a MacBook Air 11-inch, the first generation of 11-inch, which is really nice. It's running Lion, but I keep filling the hard drive. Now, I signed up for iTunes Match, and I have iCloud. So what I want to know is, can I take off all my iTunes music without losing it? Can I take it off that hard drive and still get at it when I'm online through iTunes Match? And can I take the pictures off because they're also in iCloud or not?
So the answer on Matched is yes, if you've got it all matched. So what you need to do is in iTunes, turn on the matched status and check, because anything that's not matched or uploaded, you won't have access to. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. As long as it says matched, in all of these cases, I can delete these files and go to another computer and log into my iTunes and download it. But... And this, by the way, I'm sorting in order to see this. The best thing to do is to sort by iCloud status. You wouldn't. By the way, this is not normally on here. You have to right-click the top here, this status bar, and choose iCloud status. And also turn on iCloud download because that's that little cloud. Okay, so I've turned those both on. Another thing to turn on that I recommend is bitrate and kind, because then you're going to see a little bit more about what's going on with these files. So I'm sorting now by status. If I go to the bottom, you see these are things that it couldn't match. It uploaded them. So that's fine. They're things that, for whatever reason, iCloud couldn't find.
Maybe it didn't have, you know, it doesn't have the turn the table turkey theme. So it uploaded it. Now, this concerns me because I don't see a little download button. That means I may not be able to get access to it. You want to see this little cloud download. Anything that's got the cloud, you can click the cloud and it will download it. Even if it was uploaded. See, I'm not sure why some of these don't have that cloud. I guess I, for whatever reason, I can't download it. So that's important. Oh, maybe it's already there. Oh, doy. Here, let's see. That's a good question. That's a good... I should be able to double-click this.
And play it.
Yeah. So you're right. It's on the machine. So that's why it doesn't have that little status update. Oh. Hey, you recognize that, did you?
Movie night, baby.
It's a wave file, too. That might have something to do with it. I don't know if it uploads waves or not. So you look at the status here. And that'll tell you what's going on. If everything is matched or uploaded, if it has that little download button next to it, you can safely delete it and recover it as long as you have match turned on that computer. So that is a really nice feature. In fact, it's one way to turn everything you have into high-quality AAC files without copy protection. So if you have in the past bought a lot of iTunes tracks that had DRM, had digital rights management or copy protection on them, this is a way to remove that. Make sure they're matched, then delete them and re-download them, and now you'll have a 256 kilobit unprotected AAC file which you can move around. It does have your email in it, so you shouldn't be sharing it with friends, but see, there's a lot of uploaded, but the difference is uploaded and matched. This is interesting. So this is a matched 256 kilobit MPEG. If I download this... If I download this, it should turn into an AAC, right? Yeah, see, it's downloading. Yeah, there you go. So it turned that MPEG file into a 250, which is, by the way, a better quality, probably a better quality file. So I had ripped this, apparently, at some point, or bought it maybe on Amazon. Probably bought it on Amazon. And now it's matched to AAC. Sega? $25 a year. But you only need to pay for it once to get all the matching features. That's permanent. You continue to pay if you want to have the continue to be able to stream to your phone. But that's a lot. So I would do it once. Replace your entire library. And then if you don't want to pay for it again, don't. But in effect, it's a piracy fee. You pay that fee, and you get to replace all of your pirated music with good quality AACs.
Clean up your room, clean up your room. Clean up your room. So I went and cleaned up my room. Now I can go play.
That's for you, Earl. Clean up your room. I bet you, parents now tweet their kids, dinner time. Did anybody ever do that? You get tweeted? You get text, I bet. Yeah. I remember we bought a bell. So my mom, because she got tired of saying, "Hey, Leo, it's dinner time." So she'd ring a little bell. Ding-a-ding-a-ding. So now, how do your parents let you know to come down? We have a teenager in the room. That's why I'm picking on the teenagers here. How do your parents let you know to come down for dinner? They shout? They text you. I text my kid now. "Henry, it's dinner time. Get down here." Sometimes I'll have to say things like, "I've got sausages." That works. Sure. Yeah, it worked for you too, right? Yeah. Sausages. Works for my dog. Snossages. Alan Malventano, who is brilliant, wonderful guy. He is an expert on solid-state drives, writes for PCPer.com, and is a regular on their podcast, tweeted me, "OBHi does not need their servers once configured." So I am no longer... This is good news. I thought that I was probably using the OB servers to signal my phone, but he says, no, you're doing it all from that OB device.
So you pay the 37 or 47, whatever it is, bucks, depending on the device you get. And for the rest of your life now, as long as Google Voice doesn't go away, you're going to be able to use your Google Voice for free. And you don't have to pay a fee. You've got a, I've got a phone now. I got a cheap, you know, a cheap cordless Motorola, I think, for phone, $20. It's like having a real phone, with the one exception of 9/11. So thank you, Alan, for that. He says a new one can also be configured manually without ever touching the OB server. So once you've got that account set up, you're done. That's nice to know. Doug in Murrieta, California. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Doug.
Good afternoon, Leo.
Is it Murrieta, California or Murrieta, Georgia?
California.
All right.
A couple of questions. One, I'm looking to finally upgrade into the smartphone world. And been trying to, I'm with Verizon, been trying to wait for the Note to come around.
Yeah, they keep saying the journal, and I haven't seen it yet.
I know. You know, I checked it out at AT&T. I liked it.
Oh, I love it. It's a, now, this is that Android phone that's ginormous. It's a 5.3-inch screen. I call it a phablet, a phone tablet. Yeah. But I love it. I've been very happy with the Galaxy Note. If you've got big enough hands, you can still put it in your pocket, but it's just it's a great compromise between a smaller phone and a full-size tablet.
Yeah, and but I just haven't seen it come through, so I'm debating now whether I should just go with the S3 or...
Verizon is going to be doing the S3. Now, this isn't quite as big. It's 4.8 inches, but notice what I carry now. I was carrying a Galaxy Note until the S3 came out. I love the S3. Now, I'll tell you one of the reasons it's a good alternative to the Note. It's the same screen resolution. Smaller size, but still 1280 by 720, which means you get as much on the screen. It's just a little bit smaller. It does mean you can, with one hand, do things that took two hands on the Galaxy Note because it was so big. It's a little easier to pocket. My experience with battery life is that even though it's a somewhat smaller battery on the S3, it is as good as, if not better, than the Galaxy Note. And it is a gorgeous form factor. It's very thin, very beautiful. I would say if since Verizon hasn't announced the Galaxy Note, go for the S3. It's fabulous.
Okay, so you like it better overall than the Note?
I am. Well, yeah, one thing the Note has that this doesn't have, it has a stylus. And now, for some people, if I were really good at drawing, the Note would be a good choice because it's a big enough screen and with a stylus, and it's pressure sensitive, by the way. So you can really draw beautiful stuff on it. So if you like handwriting notes or drawing, that might be an argument to wait for the Note or to get the Note on another carrier. I don't. I don't miss the stylus. In every other respect, it's very good. It's ice cream sandwich, the latest, well, almost the latest version of Google's Android operating system. It is super fast. It's LTE because it's Verizon. So you get, if you're in an LTE area, and I think you are, you'll get great bandwidth. I can't think of a reason against it.
Okay. Yeah, I am. Don't want to switch to AT&T from Verizon,
yeah,
so that's why I've been waiting, but it's just the Note's never come through. One, I did like the aspect of having the stylus and being able to, handwrite some little notes.
Yeah.
But somebody said that's a possibility on the S3, too.
They do sell, yeah. So there is a S Pen on the Samsung Galaxy Note. They call it the S Pen. You can get a stylus, and in fact, apparently it's a pressure-sensitive screen. I didn't know this. On the Galaxy S3, but you have to buy the stylus, and they call it the C Pen. So it's capacitive.
Okay.
That means it's probably not. I don't know. I haven't used it. I don't know if it's as good. It does. Okay. So they're telling me no, it's not a pressure sensitive screen. So that gives you a big difference.
Okay.
From a style point of view, the Galaxy S3 is the most beautiful phone I've ever held. It's just fantastic.
Okay. Then my secondary question is kind of a little more complicated. I'm also looking at getting the tablet or, an iPad versus a Galaxy version.
Well, if you have an Android phone, you might really want to look at an Android tablet. I do think the iPads are hands down the best tablet out there.
Okay.
They're just remarkable. But, for $200, the Galaxy or the Samsung Nexus 7, it's a 7-inch tablet. I think it's a very compelling product. I like it a lot. And the nice thing is you're going to be buying apps on your phone that will also work on your tablet.
Now, I went to Verizon, looked at the 10.1.
No, I wouldn't get that. I would. They'll have the Get Nexus 7 soon. If they don't, you can get it directly from Google. That's, to me, at $200, that's the best one to get.
And does that have the 4G capability, direct connect?
It does not. But you have hotspotting in your phone.
Yeah, I just am using it kind of for business, so I didn't want to have the phone not available for calls if I'm on the tablet.
I see.
And that's why I was looking at...
Yeah, and Verizon won't let you take calls while you're doing the LTE hotspotting.
Right.
Interesting challenge here.
Yeah, I started looking at, the Galaxy and that, so the Toshiba.
If you really want a 4G tablet and you're using it for work, get the iPad. It's really much better.
Get the iPad.
Yeah.
Okay.
And if you were getting an iPhone, I'd say absolutely, because, again, you buy apps on the iPhone, and they all are also on the, you don't have to buy them again for the tablet in most cases.
Okay. Read a lot online about the different detractions. Some people hate the iPad. Some people don't.
You know, it used to be that there was no question the iPad was absolutely superior to anything out there in the market. I think Android tablets have come along a lot with Ice Cream Sandwich. I played with the Nexus 7, Google's inexpensive 7-inch tablet, and I'm very impressed. I think it is very good. And, of course, the app ecosystem on Android now is equivalent to that on the Mac. Or on the iPad. So, you know, there are very few apps that are iPad only. Almost everybody, including some really remarkably good iOS apps like Path and Flipboard, are now on Android. There are very few apps that aren't on Android. So I think the distance is narrowed. The iPad's still the winner, but not by as much. Just by a nose. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hey, our show today brought to you by my friends at Ford. The Ford Focus Electric is out now. Have you seen it? This is your weekend assignment, just for fun. You will thank me, I promise you. Luis was in here yesterday. He works for a large computer manufacturer, which I'll remain nameless, and drives a lot of rental cars. He says, every time I try to get the Focus, it is a great car to drive. And now the new Ford Focus Electric is amazing. I mean, the torque, for instance, that you get on an electric engine. People sometimes think, oh, it's going to be boring and slow. No, this thing will kick your butt. It is a great little car. It's a beautiful vehicle. I highly recommend it. And if you go to your EV certified, you could do this weekend. Go to your EV certified Ford dealer. You could test drive it. And when you do, bring your smartphone, because then you can try the new My Ford mobile app. You know, Ford thinks of their vehicles as a platform now. I love this. This is a reimagining, if you want to use that Microsoft term, of what a car is, what a vehicle is. It is a platform. They put in the sensors, the capabilities, the API, the programmability, so that a software developer can write a phone app on Android or BlackBerry or iPhone that interfaces with the car. It's amazing. And Ford, as an example, has created their own app. It's the My Ford mobile app. You're seeing it if you're watching the video on the screen. If you bring your smartphone to the EV-certified Ford dealer, say, I want to test drive the electric and I want to try the app, you get an idea of what this can do. It's so cool. Things like, for instance, you can't lose your car. It tells you not only where it is, it gives you tips. It tells you what the charge state is. It will, in fact, if you're in the living room and the car's in the garage plugged in, you can say, hey, only charge it at the lowest utility rate. And it knows, and it does. It's called the value charging feature, powered by Microsoft. They'll give you maps of all the charging stations, so you're never far from a charging station. It'll plan the most eco-friendly route for you. It even keeps track of how much you've saved. They have the My Ford mobile website has a... leaderboards on who saved the most CO2 today, this week or this year. I'm a little competitive. I like that feature, you know, because when you're saving your CO2, you're also saving money. It's very, very cool. You can precondition your cabin temperature. You say, look, I get up, my go time, they call it, is 8:30 in the morning. You can make sure the car is exactly the right temperature, 72 degrees when you get in it.
And you do that on while it's plugged in, so that, you know, saves you money. I just, all in all, this is very progressive thinking about what a vehicle is. It's a platform. And the apps they've got, the vehicle itself, the technology. You can find out more at Ford.com/technology. I get tweets from people all the time who've bought new Fords who are so happy. This is a very sweet vehicle. The 2012 Ford Focus Electric, available now. Next year, they've got a whole bunch more, including that plug-in hybrid, the Energy, the Ford Fusion Energy. And, of course, the apps will go across the board. Ford.com/technology to learn more. Or, you know, take a Sunday afternoon. Go to your Ford dealer and say, I want to drive the Focus, and I want to test drive the My Ford mobile app. I love it. And in this heat wave, it's nice to say, yeah, make the car cool before I get in it. Wouldn't that be nice? Make the car 72 degrees. I'd like that. All right. We're coming back. Oh, they're still cheaper, Bill B. Not only do we have the highest electric rates, we also have the highest gasoline prices. We're well over $4 a gallon on gas. So believe me, it's still cheaper. Even though electricity might be more expensive here, it's still cheaper. You get 110 MPGE on this thing. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. We welcome Nathan, Ron, and Shirley visiting from, where are you visiting? Alameda? East Bay of California. Nice to have you here. I hope you listen to the show on News Talk 910 KKSF every Sunday afternoon. Also visiting from Baston, the Cavanaughs. Nice to have you guys. And you're local. You're from Alameda. All right. Nice to have you. I don't think we're in Boston yet. We're working on it. But you know what's amazing? The internet is everywhere now. Yeah. We have viewers all over the world. You use an internet radio? Which one do you like? Logitech. Yeah, the what do they call it? The box, the squeeze box, something like that. Yeah. I have a Grace Mondo thing. And it's a great internet radio. It's like a real radio, but it uses the internet. You can listen to almost every station is online now, international stations. Pandora's on it. It's really cool. The internet is a good thing. I hope it lasts. Those of you who you might want to pay attention. Tomorrow, there might be a little interruption, a little hiccup in your get-along. This because of this DNS changer malware that was so endemic on the internet a few years ago. The FBI arrested the perpetrators. They were in Estonia in November. And it was interesting. These bad guys were doing, they had created their own DNS server. So, you know, when you go out on the internet, it happens on your radio, but on your machine, in this case, it only affected Windows machines. But whenever you go out on the internet, you need a number. They call it a dotted quad. It's four numbers separated by periods, like 192.168.1.1. You see it all the time. Every website has a unique one and only number like that. But, of course, nobody remembers numbers, so what we do is we do them by name. So if you go to techguylabs.com, your computer has to resolve that name into the number. And it does that using DNS, the domain name system. It'll query itself first. If it doesn't know, then it'll ask the internet service provider. If the internet service provider doesn't know, it'll ask its internet service provider all the way up to the top level. There are 13 servers around the world that contain the phone book that connects these names to numbers. So what these bad guys did was, when you got this malware on your machine, it changed how that worked. It said, no, don't ask the internet service provider. Go to our server. We'll tell you where to go. Yeah. And you could see the problem here, of course. As soon as you said techguylabs.com, it might still give you Tech Guy Labs, but it might also put an ad on top of it. It might not take you to Tech Guy Labs. It might take you to PokerBuddies.com. And, of course, they'd get affiliate fees. And they were making millions and millions of dollars a year. The FBI busted them. They're in jail. But the FBI did an unusual thing. I think an unconscionable thing. They kept the server running. They, instead of taking the server down, which would have, by the way, broken internet access for everybody who had the bad stuff on there. You know, if you had the malware on your system and the internet, the fake bogus DNS server went away, suddenly you wouldn't be able to get on the internet. I don't think that's such a bad thing. I think that would be a signal to you. Something's wrong. Fix it. But the FBI decided, well, we don't want to do that, so we'll just keep that server running. It was running legitimately. It was doing the right thing, but they kept it running. The negative, and the reason I think this is unconscionable, the negative of that is that means there were hundreds of thousands of people, at last estimate 300,000 people worldwide, who had malware on their system, didn't know it, because everything worked. They didn't know it. And the malware might have been doing other things that the FBI didn't know about. They were just let, you know, go ahead, keep running your infected system. Who cares? Well, now the FBI's decided, we're tired of running this server. It's been 7 months, costing us too much, so they're going to take it down on Monday. So the people who, for the last 7 months, since November 2011, have been running with malware on their system but didn't know it, suddenly it's not going to work now. And now, so if your internet goes down tomorrow, that's a signal. You've had malware in your system for a while. They estimate about 70,000 in the U.S. still have DNS changer on their system, about 300,000 worldwide. Google, Yahoo, and others have been trying to warn people. Google, actually, over the last month, has been trying to put a sign up on your computer saying, hey, you've got malware, fix it. You can, if you want to find out, if you just want to reassure yourself, visit dns-ok.us. Jeez, you'd think they could have come up with a better name. You got to remember that. DNS-OK.US. And if you get a big green, it's called the DNS changer checkup. And if you get a big green sign on it, says you're okay, unless your internet service provider is redirecting traffic to protect you. But, and then, and this is really annoying. For additional information regarding the malware, please visit the FBI's website. This is just an ad. You click on this. Do you get information about how to fix it? No. You get a press release from the FBI featuring a nice picture of the assistant director in charge of the New York region. Success through partnerships. Today, with a flip of the switch, the FBI has dismantled the criminal enterprise. This is an ad. They're doing the same thing the bad guys were doing. Redirecting me to an ad. They don't tell us how to fix it. I really think they could have done this better. If you go to dns-ok.us and it is not green, you should bring your system into a reliable repair shop and get them to fix it. That's what you need to do. That's what the FBI neglects to mention in their press release. They should have mentioned it on this page. They really need to get somebody who knows what they're doing in there. That's all I can say. That's just ridiculous. You should be aware of that. Fortunately, most people will not be bit with this tomorrow. If you have any malware software on there, you're almost certainly fine. Microsoft's been updating their anti-malware program. You get this automatically when you update Windows. Chances are good you're all right. But almost certainly, the 70,000 machines that are still infected in the U.S. are old Windows 98 machines in some business sitting in the closet running, you know, some crazy bit of software that just nobody's been paying any attention to. Those will go offline. I doubt very much anybody listening to this show will have a problem tomorrow. But I thought I should let you know, just in case. And once again, a big tip of the hat to the FBI for completely mismanaging this from day one. Randy in San Fernando Valley, California. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Good afternoon, Leo.
Hi, Randy.
How's it going? I just saw a picture of you with two straws in your mouth on a picture here.
Well, you got double-fisted drinkers. I'm a double straw drinker. I love my milkshakes.
Yeah, that's funny. all right, well, you made this a little bit easier. A lot of people are suffering right now who are using Google Chrome. We're trying to fix this problem, and we're getting an error. It's going on for at least a week to 2 weeks now.
What's going on? What's happening?
It's coming up with, when we turn on the browser, it puts up, your profile could not be opened correctly. And then there's two other lines. It says, some features may be unavailable. Please check the profile exists. And you have permission to read and write its contents, unquote. So this is happening with a lot of people out there. They have, there's like no solution to it. And it's, again, every time the browser's open, maybe you can solve the problem here for myself.
Yeah, I don't know. And how do you know it's happening to a lot of people?
Going on the different groups and on the net, and a lot of people are having this problem, complaining about it. And just no one has a solution. There have been various proposed fixes where you go to the default browser and you change that stuff.
You know, there is, all right, you're on Windows? You're on Windows? There is, you know, your Google Chrome data is stored in the application data folder. Have you looked there?
Yes.
My suggestion would be, and this is true anytime you get, what's happening here is that for some reason, this can happen for a variety of reasons, the Google can no longer change your user data or read your user data. My suggestion, start over, delete it. So go into application data, it's in your local settings, Google Chrome user data, delete it. Start over. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. It happens to every browser, it happens to every program. If its preferences can't be read or are corrupt or get locked, and that can happen easily on any operating system, you just erase them and start over.
As I walk around everywhere, people are always asking me the two questions. One, I got a virus.
You're going to lose your shortcuts. You can't back them up because you can't access them.
A virus. And I'll tell you, the first question is hard to answer. You know, if you've got malware, you've got to reinstall your...
So let me see here. I'm looking. Mark was asking about back to my Mac. That's the feature that lets you access your Mac over the network. Still got to find my iPhone.
Trojan horses.
I don't know. You know, I think you don't do it from the website anymore. I think you just do it from the. It's not part of. It's part of iCloud, but it's a kind of an invisible part of iCloud. You just go to System Preferences, iCloud, in the System Preferences, and you enable Back to My Mac. So you actually don't even do it on the website. You just do it right here, Mark. And I didn't turn on Find My Mac because this is a desktop Mac. And if I can't find it, then maybe I need to find my brain. Well, it could be stolen, but what am I going to do if it's stolen? Now, it says set up router for better performance. Let's see what that means. Back to my Mac. Oh, maybe slow because NAT port mapping, PMP, or universal plug and play is turned off. Yes, because those are insecure. Apple's NAT PMP implementation is, in my understanding, which may be imperfect, better than UPnP. But as you know, Steve says always turn off UPnP because basically what these techniques allow software running on your computer to open firewall ports without warning you. That's not a good thing. But Xbox won't work as well either without UPnP. We're just going to leave that off. I don't care if it's slow. Now, I'll show you what this can do, which is so cool. So, these are all other Macs. This is in my apartment. That's my MacBook Retina. That's my desktop in my apartment. So, I can go... And I can log in. I'm connected as a guest, but I can read folders. These are the public folders because I'm a guest. Or I can connect as myself, and then I have access to it. And I can even, this is really awesome if you've got this turned on, share the screen. So now this is the desktop. That's my home computer. And it's running over the public internet using Back to My Mac, which is great. So you can see I have Spotify running. So I'm actually running my home computer, my desktop. This is the Octobus. It's a Mac Pro. You can see I have Diablo. Should I play Diablo over the internet from my desktop? So this is a really nice feature. Back to my Mac. When it works, is really great. And I think Apple's kind of locked it down. Oh, I have to update the launcher. That's good. So, and you can see it runs pretty well. So, it's a little confusing because this is the dock, local dock, And this is the dock in my apartment. It's pretty, the speed's pretty good, especially considering this is a giant screen. This is a 27-inch, you know, the screen is, what is it? Can't see, is that the, oh yeah, here's the resolution. It's 2560 by 1440. It's a lot of pixels it's pushing here. Let's install the update. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, the last few minutes of our show this weekend, but I'll be back next weekend and every weekend on this station talking about tech. Tell your friends, let them know there is somebody here looking out for them, representing our interest as users. And a lot of it's too bad a lot of tech journalists, and it's what happens also with people who cover, for instance, the White House or the Beltway or government. You become friends with the people you cover. The good news is I don't really like the people in the computer industry, so you can count on me for an honest opinion. I don't hang out with those people. I'm here to represent us. I'm a user. So, Randy, just to once again say this can happen. The same thing that happened with your Chrome could happen. In fact, I've seen the same tech notes from Microsoft with Internet Explorer, with Firefox, with almost any program. If for some reason, the general answer to this is if for some reason a program can't access its settings, its profiles, its user information, and that can happen for a variety of reasons. The operating system could have accidentally locked it down. It could have been corrupted or deleted. Then it's a simple thing. You just delete those settings and relaunch the program. The program will say, hey, I've never been here before. Now, you're going to lose all your settings. You're going to lose your bookmarks. It's all going to be as if you'd never had it installed, but at least it'll work. If you want to save your bookmarks, for instance, I think Chrome does keep a bookmark.html file. I know Firefox does around. You can look through those settings in the application data folder for Google Chrome. And, you know, you can move stuff out of there, save it, then re-import it. Chances are it's not the bookmarks that were corrupted. It's some other smaller file. So just start over. Scotty Hollywood, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Scotty.
Hey, thanks for taking the call.
My pleasure. Thanks for calling. What can I do for you? Scotty, you're breaking up. I don't know if you're on Skype or you're on a cordless, but you're breaking up and I can't quite understand you.
Could you hear me now?
Yeah. Are you on Skype?
No, I'm on a cell phone.
Ah, that's it. Yeah, just kind of aim yourself towards the cell site.
Okay, so listen, Leo, here's the question.
No, can't understand you. Sorry, Scotty. Lynn in Cherry Valley, California. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hey, iPad Touch, they got all wet.
Uh-oh.
And what do I do about that, man?
Can
I say hi to my wife, Beth? She's driving down the freeway on her way to work.
Hey, Beth. I got this one, Jason. I picked up the wrong line. So if a product gets wet, any electronics product, the first thing to do, unplug it. Second thing to do, remove the battery. Unfortunately, on iOS devices, you can't, can you? The reason is you want to pull power from those devices. The water can short circuit stuff. And if there's power on a device, if for instance, I drop my cell phone into a puddle, first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to pop the battery out of the cell phone. So there's no power going across any of the circuits. Now, I want it to dry thoroughly before I reapply power. A couple of ways to do that. Do not put it in a microwave oven. Do not put it in a regular oven. I've heard of people doing both. Bad idea. I have heard of people putting it in a Tupperware container with rice, dry, not cooked rice, dry rice, because, of course, the rice absorbs moisture. Better yet, if you've got some desiccant packets, you know, whenever I get those little packets, you know, it says do not eat in electronic gear, I put them in a Tupperware so they don't absorb more moisture. Remember, they'll absorb any moisture in the air. So you seal them in a dry environment. In fact, you can also recover these sometimes by baking them at a very, very low temperature to remove all the moisture. Then seal them in a Tupperware. And then you can use that to desiccate this or just let it sit for a long, long time. And I don't mean an hour. I don't mean a day. I mean days or even weeks, depending on how much you love this device. But you've got to get it bone dry. Then, if you're lucky, you can reapply power. Now, Apple has a patent on its devices, and all cell phones use something similar. I'm looking at my Galaxy 3, and I can see there's a little piece of paper in it. And the iPhone has a little piece of paper as well that will turn color when it gets wet. The Apple patent is that they don't have to open the device to look. They can actually, and I've had this happen at the Apple store, look into the earphone port and see it. And if it's red, you got wet. They can also look in the 30-pin port on the Apple iPhone. And if it's red, you got wet. They'll know. So never lie to a company about whether you got the phone wet or the device wet, because they know. You may be able to still get it repaired. Apple's been very nice to me. I brought mine in, and I dunked it in a glass of water to test a waterproofing system that didn't work. I did exactly the wrong thing. It was an iPhone, and I tried to turn it on. No, bad thing. I should have turned it off. I would have pulled the battery if I could. Let it sit. Let it dry. Don't apply power till it's fully dry. It's hard to do with an iPad or an iPhone because you can't pull the battery, but at least don't try to turn it on. It's the natural thing. Let it dry for days or weeks before you try to turn it on. And if it still doesn't turn on, well, maybe the short happened the minute it got wet. Water is the problem. That's really the problem. And the idea is to keep it from short-circuiting or damaging it any further. Often, you know, if only one part got damaged, they could replace it. The problem with iPads is there's no user serviceable parts inside. In fact, there really aren't any serviceable parts, period. Apple just gives you a new one. Same thing with the iPhone. There's not much they can do to fix it. Unfortunately, it's true of all of the Apple gear. By the way, we are hearing very strong rumors now that this fall Apple will announce its first 7-inch iPad, a 7.68. Either it's a giant iPod Touch or a mini iPad. It's funny because Steve Jobs got very famously last year got on an analyst call, just kind of showed up, not normally on these calls, and said, "Oh, by the way, these 7-inch tablets," he was talking about the Galaxy 7-inch tablet, "they're 45% smaller than an iPad. We will never, ever make one of these." He was prone to that kind of an announcement. And for that reason, a lot of us think, well, I don't think Apple will ever, ever make a 7-inch iPad. But the rumors are so strong at this point, it'd be hard to ignore them. We'll find out this fall when Apple announces the next iPhone. I'm starting to think they will. I have to say, a 7-inch tablet is a good size because, you know, that tablet that Steve was railing against, I loved that, the Galaxy Tab 7. That was a great, perfect size. A little smaller than the iPad, but a little bigger than the phone. You could put it in your pocket. I've been playing with the Google Nexus 7. Great. So maybe Apple finally will realize the Kindle, the Nexus 7, products like that, which are 7-inch tablets, are good enough for a lot of people. Let's see. Lynn. Now we go to Lynn and Cherry. I pressed the wrong button. Now we go to Lynn and Cherry Valley. Hi, Lynn.
Hi, Leo. This is Joe. I'm her husband.
Oh, okay.
So I'm going to, but same situation here. We've got a, we had a crash, and not really a crash, but it was a virus. And we called our local technician to do the, to do the repair for us. And we're trying to find, and he's left us without our information.
Yeah. So what he did is the right thing to do, but the really right thing to do is to warn you before he did it and give you a chance to back up or make a backup for you. He wiped your drive. When you have a virus, that is the right thing to do. Wipe the drive and reinstall from a known good source. That does not include your data. So it's up to you to have a backup or up to him, in this case, to have told you that's what he's going to do and say, can you make a backup or I will make a backup for you. Did you ask him if he made a backup?
Yes, he did twice because I won't spend a lot of time explaining it all. But really where we're at right now is trying to determine whether a PST file is the only place it saves.
The PST file is one thing and one thing only. It's an Outlook data file. That's your email, calendar, and address book.
Okay.
It is not anything else.
Okay, and that's where there's some problem because it only comes up to 2008, and then between 2008 and now.
So he backed up your data, but all he got was one file?
Apparently so. That's all we can't. So
he did not back up your data. That's just your Outlook file. He didn't back up your data. He backed up one file, and it sounds like it wasn't even the file. It was an old archive file. Outlook will do this. It archives your data because these PST files, they don't want to get too big. You're looking for a file called outlook.pst. That'll be the most recent Outlook data. If you don't have that, and it sounds like you don't, it sounds like you've got the archive it made up to 2008. He didn't make a backup, Bill. He's lying to you, or he didn't know what he's doing, and he didn't make a backup.
Okay. And then the Apple file for all her music, you know, she's concerned that she's not going to be able to go. If she turns on her iPod and goes online, that it's going to remove all.
Yes, it will. It'll say, I've never seen this iPod before. Do you mind if I erase it and sync it? Don't do that. So,
don't
do that. You have one backup now. It's your iPod. You need to get the data off it. Look for a program called Snooty. It's iTunes backwards. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Guy lost everything. And I could have helped him, but we're out of time. Well, that's it for the Tech Guy show for today. I'm Leo Laporte. Thank you so much for joining us. Don't forget, the Tech Guy is just the tip of the iceberg. We do nearly 30 shows now on the Twit Netcast Network, and you'll find them all at twit.tv. We talk about Windows on Windows Weekly, Macintosh on MacBreak Weekly, iPad on iPad Today. You get your daily dose of tech news from Tech News Today and our weekly roundtable show, This Week in Tech. It's all at twit.tv. And I'll be back next time with another great Tech Guy podcast. Thanks for joining me. See you next time.